This episode of the Rick Emerson Show is made possible by our good friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
I want to go home. I don't want to go to Wally World.
Clark, under the circumstances, I wouldn't mind if we just went home. In retrospect, it seems like a pretty bad idea driving out. It's been one disaster after another.
Yeah, it's been a real drag, Dad. Maybe we can try it some other time. Wally World's overrated anyway.
What do you think?
I think you're all f***ing in the head. We're 10 hours from the f***ing fun park and you want to bail out. Well, I'll tell you something. This is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun. I'm going to have fun and you're going to have fun. We're all going to have so much fun. We'll need plastic surgery to remove our goddamn smiles. You'll be whistling Symphony Doodah out of your holes. I gotta be crazy. I'm on a pilgrimage to see a moose. Praise Marty Moose. Holy shit.
Dad, you want to ask for something?
Don't touch.
Sorry, folks. We're closed for 2 weeks to clean and repair America's favorite family fun park. Sorry.
Clark, what are you doing?
We watch his program. We buy his toys, we go to his movies.
He owes us. Doesn't he owe us? Huh? He owes the Griswolds, right? F***ing A, right, he owes us.
It is 19 minutes after the hour of one, and this the month of November in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along and making a part of your listening day. We are live from the lushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, America's new home for fun and amusements. It is Monday. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for coming by. It is Monday, November 9th, 2010, and welcome to day 101. We appreciate your presence and your patronage on this fine afternoon. It's 503-505-6964 if you would like to join us in speechifying or telephonizing or something like that. 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964 if you would like to engage with us telephonically today with your comments, questions, clarifications, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature, whatever it is you might have. Perhaps your own observations about how best to prepare arugula. Whatever it is that's on your mind. 503-505-6964. You can also Skype if you like. The Skype username is Rick Emerson Show. That is Rick Emerson Show. Text box at rickemerson.com. Or you can email as well. That's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be reached. Can't you, Don?
I can.
That's
I
right.
Can indeed.
At Don, D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com. That is D-A-W-N at rickemerson.com. Before we go any further, we want to thank listeners Sam and Jessica who came by today. Now it's become this whole weird law of inversion where the more we tell people that it just makes us feel weird, and you don't get Catholic guilt, you just get regular guilt.
Yeah.
You get regular secular guilt.
I just get weirdly awkward, like what do they want from me? Why are they giving me things?
Listeners Sam and Jessica came by. So Sam, I think with some input from Jessica, I think she had the actual idea. He was the guy that created the R2-D2 Geek-O-Lantern, which was awesome, by the way. And
yes,
they were all awesome. I have to say, they were all really, really great. That was the... It seems wrong to say that the one with me as Kim Jong-il was there. That was the first one that really leapt off the screen as being awesome. But I will say that...
That was the first one we got.
It was the first one we got. I will say the thing about the R2-D2 one is that was the first of the submissions that... It was the first of the submissions that it seemed like it was a kind of new school of pumpkin carving.
Yeah.
Because it had never, this is what I've told them, it never occurred to me that you could actually take sections of the pumpkin or a pumpkin off and put them on the outside.
Mm.
It's like the, It's like that show that was on this year that everybody on the planet seems to have watched, the extreme pumpkin carving thing. Did you watch that? Did you guys
no,
about this?
I never. Okay, actually, so I didn't actually see it. I've seen a lot of pictures on the internet though of people who have just had just amazing pumpkins this year, just insanely artistic and complex pumpkins.
It's really weird, especially when you consider the fact that there was nothing stopping us from doing it for like you know. All of human history. It's not like there's any new technology or anything. I mean, if you see the guy on, I think it was the Food Channel, and Jessica and Sam, it turns out, to watch this as well. On the Food Channel, they had this extreme pumpkin carving competition, which sounds dorky, but then you watch it, and it's just like mind-blowingly awesome. And all the stuff they're using are just like basic. I mean, most of them just used a single knife, and then like maybe like a... like a thing that kind of looked like it kind of looked like an ice pick to just do like fine detail work, but it wasn't like they were using you know like something that had just been invented last year. There's no reason we couldn't have been carving pumpkins this whole time, and yet up until about 5 years ago, everybody just did what we did growing up, was right. You just do the triangles and you try not to cut yourself.
Yeah, it was about 10 years ago, which was the first time I ever saw anybody doing the thing where you didn't carve all the way through
into just the meat of the pumpkin.
Yeah, and that was a new thing.
See, that's
and now this year it seems to be the thing of like. Carving into the outside and doing something sculptural, you know, into the meat of the pumpkin, leaving most of the pumpkin intact, but carving like an actual sculptural face out of the and that's brand new.
That's what this guy who won the extreme pumpkin thing did. He had a he created a Medusa, and then he carved then snakes, which then by means of this motor that he put inside, the snakes actually sort of moved around.
Dear Lord.
It was just mind-blowing. Anyway, so Sam and Jessica came by. Sam was the carver of the R2-D2 pumpkin. He won the Doctor Who USB TARDIS hub.
Yes.
Which is just freaking awesome in and of itself. Anyway, so they came by. Very very gracious, very wonderful. And then they brought us Viso.
Yeah.
Which, don't get me wrong, I'm going to drink it. In fact, listen, hold on. Right there. I'm drinking it right now. My guilt only goes so far. The guilt is, here's the thing, guilt doesn't preclude thirst or desire for caffeine.
Yeah, that's my problem when people give me gifts and I'm not expecting them and I don't really feel like I deserve them. I just feel like, oh, you really shouldn't have. I mean, I'll take it.
But I'll take it.
I'm not gonna turn it down, don't get me wrong.
No illusions about that.
But, I feel awkward as I take it.
But thanks.
And then greedily giggle because I have stuff.
Let's see. By the way, I'm just going to read these two random messages that I received. Message number one. Holy crap, I just checked out ThinkGeek.com. I'm ordering the Enterprise Pizza Cutter right now.
You know, dude, if you had done that last month, you would have gotten a discount.
Saving yourself money is what you would have done,
sir. We had a code.
Let's see. Second message. I don't even know what this is in response to. The second message just says, I hate Vicodin. They make me horny, but then my junk don't work. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate you weighing in. Thank you for taking the time to decide. That's exactly what the DARPAnet was created for, sir. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. It is Monday. Here's what's coming up in today's program. We got your corpse watch on the way. We got your penis watch on the way. We got your top five. Today we will do the top five songs about zombies. That is the top five songs about zombies because of Walking Dead, which aired again last night. So we get the top five zombie songs on the way. Mr. Aaron Duran will be joining us for the Week in Geek later on this hour, about 25 minutes from now, about 1:50 or so Pacific time if you are listening to this live. The Week in Geek with Aaron Duran. We also got some news from my hometown of Kennewick, Washington, courtesy of listener Dan. Thank you. Let's see. What else? We'll do the recap of last night's episode of Walking Dead. You watched Boardwalk Empire?
I did, indeed.
Recap last night's Boardwalk Empire. And I know you're not done with Eastbound and Down, and that's fine.
No.
I'm done thinking less of you. I thought less of you for about 25 minutes, but now I've moved past it. All I'm saying is this. I'm not spoiling anything. These are not spoilers. I'm just saying you have yet to see some of the greatest lines ever uttered on that program. Seamus actually just sent me an email right now. He says, here's my favorite Eastbound and Down quote from last night. And this is something that Kenny Powers says. Guess I should just go be a cold, calculated killing machine out there on the mound, just striking out idiots joylessly, going through the motions, because no one loves me and my heart is dead. He says that at one point, and then a thing. I actually set this as a Twitter and as a Facebook update last night, and it's one of those things. Do you ever do this where you post something on Facebook and Twitter, and you realize later that unless somebody has a very specific context in which to put whatever it is you've typed, it's either not going to make any sense at all, or it's going to just be borderline insane or offensive or crazy or otherwise weird.
That's pretty much a daily occurrence for me. Yes.
Yeah, it's like sometimes if you're quoting a movie or something, and it's like if somebody doesn't know you're quoting a movie, and you realize that whatever you just said, it just seems horribly inappropriate.
That has happened to me on Facebook. Like I'll even put something in quotation marks, which kind of, I think, makes it clear that I'm quoting something else.
Right.
And then I get people responding to me as if I had said that myself. And if they're kind of freaked out and horrified by it, then I just feel sort of embarrassed. But sometimes they'll just think I'm hilarious.
Right.
Because I just wrote, I said the funniest, and I have to go,
and then you don't want to correct them, though, because you'll be like, no, I was just quoting somebody who's funnier.
Yeah.
So I put this as a Twitter update last night. It's better to be strangled by a necklace of Mexicans than to be strangled by no one at all. And it was that thing where I posted it, and then strangely enough, there was no one liked that on Facebook. There's nobody.
Really?
Nobody really chimed in to agree with that sentiment. Well, all right. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Monday.
Art believed destroyed by the Nazis has been found in Berlin. Texas is considering dumping Medicare. And the Dutch get marijuana scratch and sniff cards.
Awesome. Well done, the Dutch. All right, so that is all on the way. So we'll recap Boardwalk Empire, recap Walking Dead, talk a bit about Eastbound and Down, which you will probably not have finished. I'll talk a bit about it, but then we can do the actual recap tomorrow.
Well, if you want to just, you know, talk about stuff over there on your side of the table, I could just sit over here and watch it now and catch up.
No, this is not the proper environment in which to view it. I don't want to, you know.
Because, you know, I don't mind. I don't mind watching TV on your dime.
No, that's fine. I just, you should be able to just sort of, you know, relax and put your feet up and just watch it in the proper environment and context.
And honestly, no matter what you say, even, you know, it's like, there's no spoiler so great that it's, like, still going to make it not enjoyable when I watch it.
That's the thing. With Kenny Powers, it's all about the journey. All right. In any event. This is all true. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. And by the way, speaking of, just real quickly, speaking of Eastbound and Down, because last night, I mean, it's like I really worked at getting everything watched last night, and it just didn't happen. I once again failed to watch Dexter, and I had this whole plan where I was going to get up early this morning, and watch it because Laura and I went to dinner. We had this, it wasn't like a double date as such, but it's like we had, I guess, I don't know if I should talk about this or not, because I don't know if they listen.
Does it even really count as dating? If you're going out and doing something with your spouse.
Well,
I've never said that whole, we're going out, it's date night.
Well,
she
and I are married. The other couple, they're not. They're just dating.
Okay.
So I'm doing like 15 calculations in my head right now because I don't know if the other couple listens. They may or they may not. Well, then, if it doesn't matter. I'm going to say this. If this is going to get me in trouble, it's going to happen eventually anyway. So the thing is that, so Laura and I went out last night with her friend, C, and I won't use his name. I will make that one concession. I won't say his name, which is sort of ridiculous because they'll know exactly that I'm talking about them. So I don't know who I'm protecting by not using his name. His name's Trevor.
I wonder if they went out to dinner with someone else last night.
I mean,
had exactly the same experience.
As soon as I said that, I realized it made no sense. His name's Trevor. We go out with Trevor and Trevor's lady friend, a woman with whom he has been spending much social and romantic time over the last whatever. But the thing is that we, and especially my wife, Lara is really good friends with Trevor and has been for a long time. And we were sort of, I think it was indicated to Lara at some point that we all needed to go out together for some sort of event or dinner or a date or whatever. Like, all four of us had to go out, and I had to be there because I think it's the deal where Trevor's really good friends with my wife, and I think Trevor's girlfriend was a little uncertain about that. I think she was made, I mean, you know, I'm not saying you do that, but you know what I'm talking about. You know that whole thing. Whereas I think the girlfriend was made a little uneasy by the fact that he is such a good friend with my wife and that they spend a lot, they just hang out together a lot.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
They hang out in the way, in the sort of like, you know, because they get along really well, and he's a great guy, but they hang out in that sort of like easy, familiar way that sometimes people do if they've been intimate in the past. Like he'll just come over and whatever, just, you know, play Xbox or just, you know, or just booze or something. And I think she was sort of, thinking that maybe there was more to the story than she'd been told. So I had to then be there basically as, like, husband of Lara You know, who's, you know, I think like my presence indicated then that there was nothing untoward going on. So that was, anyway, so that's what we did last night. But so we're all there. Pardon me.
So and honestly, of course, you know, once this other woman sees you on her arm, she'll really, oh, well, yeah, well,
why am I dating Trevor?
What would she want with my man?
That's right. Thank you, Don. So we're all at dinner last night and we're doing whatever. And then, you know, and the other woman is, you know, like looking at a watch because she gets up at like 4 a.m. to go to work. And she's going, well, we need to call it a night pretty soon because I got to get up at 3:30 because I got to be to work at 4 or whatever. And I was realizing that, you know, my entire night consisted of, like, because I've been telling Lara the same thing as, like, when we go to dinner. And you probably do this with Patrick, where when you go to dinner, you have, like, a verbal signal for when it's time to leave. Like, you're going to go, I'm going to bring up a whole thing about having to shave a sheep. And then once I do that, you then say, oh, we got to get going because we got to get up early for work. And we didn't have to use the verbal signal last night because the woman herself was like, oh, I got to get going. So I didn't have to bust out, like, our secret code for having to get home because my entire evening was that I had to get home because I had, like, 5 hours of television that had to be watched before today. And they all have real jobs. It's like, you know, my wife is a nurse. The other woman is a nurse. And like a serious, like a hardcore, like an ICU nurse. Trevor's going to law school. And meanwhile, my entire night is that I got to get home because I got all this TV to watch, before I can, go to bed so I can get up.
You know, I can't do my job if I haven't watched all the TV.
And I still didn't get it all watched. So I watched Walking Dead. I watched Boardwalk Empire. I watched Eastbound and Down. And then, you know, but by that time it was like 2:30 in the morning or something, and I just had to call it a night, and I didn't watch Dexter. So, and it was a long way to get to that story, but I've got that whole triage thing going on of what I need to watch and when. So we'll recap two of those shows, glancingly reference a third. I'll get to a fourth maybe tomorrow. We'll talk Dexter at some point in the immediate future. So that was the extent of my evening. How was your weekend, Don?
My weekend was awesome. My weekend was epic. Got a whole bunch of chores taken care of that needed to be done that were very important, including on Saturday I went out and I bought a couple of new bras, which may not sound like a big deal to the masculine members of the audience, but the ladies know bras are important, and a decent bra is important. And for the last several months, I have been wearing substandard bras.
When you say substandard, you mean the wrong size?
No, I mean like not really quite supportive enough.
Yeah, men don't have to deal with
it. They're really comfortable. They're like, I was like wearing like kind of a tank sports bra kind of a thing and something else. And so they're just really, they were comfortable, but really not, I didn't feel like I was really getting the,
sexifying?
No, it's not even sexifying. It's just like, you know, wrangling them into place and keeping them so that when I'm walking, I don't feel like I'm bouncing or jiggling in some sort of untoward
wrangling
fashion.
Them into place.
Well, yeah.
Like you're putting down a calf in a 3-point hold.
There is a certain point when you are 73 years old like I am, you are basically just sort of gathering them up and shoving them into a sling, you know, so
like a gunny sack of marbles.
But don't my boobs look awesome today?
I wouldn't know, Don. I'm keeping eye contact here. Can I just tell you, by the way, now I'm glad you mentioned this, A, because I like any chance to talk about bosoms, and B, because moments before we went on the air just now, it was like 10 minutes ago, I looked over, if you ladies do this and you're not even aware of it, if it's like a thing you just do 100 times a day and so therefore you don't even really recognize that, but you did reach a hand in and you like scooped something into place.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to go.
Well,
like,
actually, what I was doing
what
is
that
I was
all about?
What you saw is I was adjusting
a strap.
A strap.
Okay.
Because this new bra and the straps could actually be
okay.
Adjusted a little short.
Well, they
so
look.
It was
slimy, they look fine. They look. Pert.
They look awesome.
I guess
they are up here where they're supposed to be.
They look a little smaller than they did last week.
They're firmly ensconced. I don't. Maybe it's.
Is it because they're being held more tightly against your body?
It might be. They are being. You know, wrangled into...
like Carrie Fisher in A New Hope.
Plus, they have this whole new bra technology that's come out the last few years where the bras, the actual cups of the bras are this very firm foam kind
yes.
of material. So, like, basically, you know, it's like, this will be the shape of your boob. And it's like, there's nothing you can do about it. It's like, here you go. And it's kind of awesome.
Hey, let me ask you this. What is the deal with chicks in the 50s and 60s having the pointy boob?
It was a style.
Okay, was that the style? That wasn't just like, that wasn't an unfortunate side effect of the technology of the brassiere?
It could be. It actually could have been probably because
like
of
maybe
the way
they couldn't
they
figure out a way to get rid of the point and still have it be supportive.
Yeah. Because another problem was for a very long time, it was really difficult to find bras that had a smooth cup. that there weren't like big seams
in
the front
of
them.
Right, yeah.
Which, if you were wearing anything that like a thin shirt, you'd just have these seam lines, which are really
right, unsightly.
Weird. Yeah, they were disturbing.
All right.
What?
And no seam.
And it's colorful, too.
And it's colorful.
You see that?
It's sort of a purple and blue kind of a thing.
I'm showing Rick the top of my bra so you can see that there's like a... It's sort of a beige, a little purple, and a mustard yellow under there. It's very awesome.
I don't have to show you my boxer shorts or something.
No, you don't, but you talk about them a lot, so I know that you have apparently a large collection of boxer shorts with many different things
today,
decorating them.
I swear to Christ, sock monkeys riding sleds.
Nice.
Would you like to see just the top of my boxer shorts?
I really would.
All right, hold on a second. Let me just, this won't be awkward at all. Hold on.
I like that we've reached this point in our relationship.
There you go.
Oh, that's adorable.
Are they not sock monkeys?
Those are so cool, yes.
All right, there you go.
Those are very nice.
All right, not just any monkey, sock monkeys. So they are, in fact, sock monkeys which have come to life sufficient to navigate a snow-based object down a hill.
But the thing about getting new bras, too, is that there's just this whole thing that, you know, you'll notice, you see women walking around and, you know, they kind of delude themselves about the size of, like, the jeans they're supposed to be wearing.
Right.
So they're too small and they're wearing the muffin tops.
Yeah.
Or something. And it's like they aren't, like, really admitting to themselves that really they need, like, a 30 and not a 26 or something like that. And the thing is, women do that with bras all the time, too. And I'm guilty of that, where it's like, well, I've always worn a 36.
Well, I hear the thing. It's like you see that thing in Cosmo every now and again. And like, are you wearing the wrong bra size? 65% of women are.
Yeah.
It's like, how would you not know you're wearing the wrong bra size? Wouldn't it hurt or wouldn't it be floppy or something?
Well, yeah. And it's uncomfortable. Also, you see a lot of women walking around where you see those like lumpy rolls, even like thin women, the lumpy rolls in their back.
Under the strap or whatever?
Yeah, well, you can see that the back of their bra is just way too
cinching
tight.
Cinching it together, yeah.
Yeah, it's because women just don't want to admit that they should be wearing, like, you know, a 38 instead of a 36.
Is that because
like
they
that.
Put on weight or something, and so therefore they don't want to... As the weight goes up, the number goes up?
Or also just sometimes even without gaining weight, your body just changes shape, too. And it's like, you know, and breasts change shape as well. And they change size. I'm actually wearing I weigh more than I used to, but I'm wearing a smaller cup size than I did at one time.
This is so perplexing.
Yeah.
We would just walk around nude all the time rather than deal with any of this.
Well, there used to be a time where you would go to a bra store or to the special bra department at the you know, department store.
And Mrs. Schroeder would help you find something that worked?
Yeah, and there's a lady who would go in there with you and, like, grab your boobs
and
put you in something and would actually, and was an expert in making sure you were fitted properly. And you have to go to, like, really super high-end lingerie stores and expensive department stores now to get that service.
Everybody's,
like, sort of guessing that they're wearing the right thing.
So that's a thing that's worthwhile, though. Like, that wasn't, they weren't just screwing you. Like, it actually was helpful to have somebody decide, you know, like, what madame should be wearing.
Yeah, they really, those ladies really know. I mean, it is creepy to have a 60-year-old woman come in and, like, you know, hold your boobs.
Well, that's like the guy, the Brooks Brothers guy asking you which way your junk hangs when they get your pants ready for you or something.
It is very much the same thing.
Which, by the way, I bought a lot of pants in my life, had many things tailored, and that is a line of demarcation. I know that I have never in my life really made a great deal of money because I've never had a guy ask me that. So I know that is how I will know when I have somehow made a sufficient amount of money or reached a sufficient level of social standing, because a guy will ask about my penis when he's sizing pants for me.
Speaking of pants,
yes,
I have in front of me. I have not purchased a Cosmopolitan magazine since I was probably like 18 years old, because let's face it, Cosmopolitan is aimed at teenagers who think this is going to tell them what it's like to be a grown-up woman. And women in their 20s who are idiots. But this magazine was there on the stand this morning as I was on my way in. And, you know, Cosmopolitan always has these covers. They say, like, one here, what your turn-ons reveal about you.
Right.
And wicked things other women do in bed, our naughtiest sex poll. And are you too big of a bitch to yourself? But the biggest headline is devoted to this. And this was just hilarious to me because it's like Cosmopolitan, they are now just cutting to the chase. They're just going straight to the heart of the matter of what their articles are about now. First, take off his pants, it says on the cover of Cosmopolitan.
That's awesome. Oh, it's fantastic. Was there sort of a gray area there? Was it a thing about which women were unclear? It was an indistinct process to them?
And then the article that it's about...
I keep trying to put on the rubber through the zipper, and it's just not working.
And then the article is about is about hand jobs.
Wow, okay.
See?
I didn't really... The sexy strokes he craves, ellipsis, but won't ask for.
Yeah, so it's an article all about how to creatively give a hand job.
Okay, thanks.
But the headline on the cover was just awesome.
And by the way, okay, now that we've just vaulted over some sort of weird dividing line in the history of this program, let me just say that first take off his pants, which I get that, but strictly speaking, that part isn't even really necessary. I suppose if the whole point is to be creative about how you're performing that particular act. Really, taking off the pants, that just seems optional. That's a generalized loosening or unbuttoning might be appropriate.
And I would say most of the time I have performed that particular
pants
act.
Pants on.
Pants have still been in play.
Also, because most of the time you've performed that act or received that act, you were probably both in high school or in a parking garage.
Shouldn't be doing what you're doing.
Somebody was on a lunch break or, somebody's boyfriend was about to come home. And so things had to be done. Things had to be handled quickly, to speak.
When my husband and I were on the bus with all the senior citizens in
Hood
River.
All right, thanks. Thanks, I appreciate that. I don't even know what I was going to say now. Wait.
Pants?
There was something about that, but no, I don't know. I was going to say this, actually. This is the thing about Cosmo, at least from my male perspective, because I used to read Cosmo really religiously. I read Cosmo way more than any woman I know, because that was largely in the pre-internet days. And if you were a zany talk show host or a kooky DJ, you couldn't just go online to you couldn't just go to FARC and just see what nutty things are happening out there that people are talking about. What can I make merry with? So you would just do, when I was a talk show host, way back when, you would go on Sunday, for example, to Borders or Barnes & Noble, and you would buy the Sunday newspaper from 15 different cities. So you'd buy the Sunday LA Times, the Sunday New York Times, the Sunday Boston Globe, the Sunday Seattle PI, the whatever. And, and you would just spend all night going through Sunday newspapers, and then you would subscribe to every magazine on earth. Because, it's difficult to imagine this now, but there just wasn't, you just didn't have access, even if you had the AP wire or whatever at the station, you just didn't have access to a lot of lifestyle news. And so guys in my profession read a lot of magazines. And you especially read magazines that dealt with relationships or lifestyle stuff, like Entertainment Weekly or Playboy. And Cosmo was a huge thing for DJs and talk show hosts to read because it was a lot of because you could get a lot of that, what is the deal with women and the fact that they be shopping or whatever, your stuff. Yeah. The thing I learned about reading Cosmo is this. That first of all, there's two things I learned about Cosmopolitan magazine. One, every third Cosmo cover had an article about how to slow him down and speed you up. And the other thing was that women have this, not unlike the HBO program Real Sex, every issue of Cosmo seemed to have some article devoted to what my friend Kurt boiled down to, just dressing up, humping. And that's how he described every episode of Real Sex, because Real Sex on HBO, and I don't even know if it still airs, but it's a thing where, it's some sad couple who are trying to put the spark back of their relationship, and it would be something where they would bake the woman into a cake or something that surrounded her most intimate areas, and then the husband would scoop away sections of the cake with a spoon or something. The husband would lay there and they would serve a meal of the finest aphrodisiac foods on his naked chest while the woman, and my friend Kurt would watch and goes, oh, they're just dressing up, humping. Just get to it already. Because none of this, and Cosmo does the same thing. They will have these articles that are just so depressing to read, and it's always just from some housefrau who is emailing about the fact that her husband, her husband finds her to be off-putting or dull or just, that she finds the husband's put on 50 pounds and he scratches his ass a lot in public and he sits there in front of the television and passes gas and woots at a football game. And, strangely enough, there just doesn't seem to be much fire left in the relationship. And Cosmo would always recommend these things what you should do is you should both go to a bar, but pretend that you don't know each other. And you can pretend to be a hooker and he'll pretend to be a sailor on leave and he can pick you up and you can go to an hourly motel and it'll put the... And you just read it, you just shake your head and then you close the magazine and then you just, go about your business because you realize that's going to help no one.
No.
So,
in any event. All right.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6969. 604-503-505-6969. 1-800-848-9864. And now I've done the obligatory, what life was like as a radio host 20 years ago? Thing, which is, you know, so there you go. This is like you talking about like laying out a newspaper in linotype or whatever it was.
Did the wax paste up stuff, yes.
Whatever it was that you all did way back in the day.
When we got our news by telegraph.
That's right.
Yes.
It's 503-505-6964. In just a few, we'll get to Mr. Aaron Duran of the Week in Geek from geekinthecity.com. We'll also do your corpse watch, your penis watch, top five zombie songs. We will recap Boardwalk Empire and Walking Dead from last night at the news desk. This is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Nearly a dozen sculptures considered by the Nazis to be degenerate artwork and believed to have been lost or destroyed after World War II have been unearthed during construction near Berlin's City Hall and were shown to reporters today. The terracotta and bronze statues were found during a dig to lay down a new subway line. They belonged to a collection of 15,000 works condemned by Hitler's regime for containing deviant sexual elements, anti-nationalistic themes, or criticizing Nazi ideology. The sculptures depict mainly women, a woman holding grapes, a mother and her child, a full-figured woman stretching, and the other three are of males. 10 of the pieces will go on display Tuesday in Berlin's News Museum. One, a male terracotta head, is too fragile to display. Construction workers found the art on the site of an office building that burned down in the summer of 1944. The fire started on the roof, burning the building from the top down. Each floor fell into the next, and everything that couldn't be burnt collected at the bottom of the basement. Judging from the placement and damage of the works, they had been stored in an office before the fire. Whether the collection also included wooden or canvas works is anyone's guess.
Hey, by the way, I hate to just be going back to the Cosmo thing again and the taking off of the pants. But, I mean, you don't really have to answer this because I don't know the article is even laid out this way. But if the article is called First Take Off His Pants,
yeah,
like how many steps do you need? I mean, it's like isn't it? I mean, step two is pretty much just is the, you know, step two and then repeat.
Well, the
I would think
the subhead is next. Treat him to the sexy strokes he's been craving all along, but won't ask for.
But I mean, is there some new way of performing that particular sexual act that I wasn't privy to before?
I don't know. I haven't actually read the article yet.
I mean, the hand based service is pretty much, I would imagine, unless things have changed substantially, since that act was invented.
Well, they're actually.
It seems like it's a 2-step process at most. I mean, maybe 3 if you count the sort of, you know, shameful zipping up and then walking back in opposite directions, pretending that you weren't in the office supplies closet.
Well, they do quote a woman named, what is her name here? Sadie Allison, who is author of a book called Tickle His Pickle.
You know, I've seen that book. And you know why I've seen that book? Because Richie Bristol owns it. And he would spend long hours back in the PA booth at CBS, leaning back in his chair, reading Tickle His Pickle while he was ignoring the phones.
Actually, I'm looking at this article now, and it actually is very detailed.
Really?
Yes, it is.
Are women that puzzled about how it is to operate the penis?
I don't know. I've always sort of felt a little bit sorry for men, because the thing is, women are very, very different.
Yes.
You know, our physical responses and the way we're designed.
I feel like a classroom film strip is playing in the background now.
But the things we like and the way we like them and that sort of thing, very different. Men, the penis is there's really not a whole lot of variation.
No.
Most men like stuff done pretty much the same way.
It's a pretty binary process.
They could come with kind of an owner's manual, honestly, because generally if you figure out something that works for one guy, that works pretty much for all of them.
No, as somebody once said, it's like the whole thing of satisfying a woman is like diffusing a bomb, where, you know, you never know. Maybe it's the red wire. Maybe it's the green wire. Maybe you cross them. Maybe you snip one. Maybe you snip both. Who's to say, really?
But the thing is that nobody actually tells men that women are all different. So some poor guy, he's like maybe had a girlfriend that he satisfied her brilliantly. So he's like, I know what I'm doing. I know all about that whole, you know, oral leaven and all that stuff. And then he gets involved with someone else and he's like, I'm just going to dive on in and do what I do. And she's like, no, I don't like it.
Well,
no.
You know,
and he doesn't know why, because women don't actually share.
Here's the thing. The thing about it is, this is another one of those things where you and I know the answer to all of the world's difficulties and problems. The problem here is that men, because they lack, as you said, and I'm not saying it's entirely women's fault, because men could ask, but women could also, women could also clue us in a little bit just by telling us.
Yeah, women don't clue men in nearly enough.
As the late, great Sam Kinison once said, women will tell everybody else. They'll tell their mom, their sister, their cousin, their hairdresser, a woman on the bus. They just won't tell you. But, you know, so men are left to sort of, you know, men are left with basically the two hands and no map kind of approach to this. But men, as a result, because they don't really know, they have to bluff their way through how to pleasure a lady. And men treat women like Mortal Kombat, where there's one finishing move and that's all you really need to know. Like, if you can do the thing where Sonya goes, "Kia!" and then shoots the fireball and then incinerates the opponent, if you know that finishing move, it doesn't matter what kind of tricky situation you or what opponent you are tangling with. It doesn't matter who's on the other side of the equation. That finishing move is going to be enough to finish them off. Here's the thing. That doesn't always work. And sometimes you find the finishing move just irritates and chafes them. And, you know, and then it, but then and then you're totally lost. Like, if you because have let me ask you this, Dawn, you're a woman. Have you ever had this happen? And I know you have, where where the guy will find something that you particularly enjoy having done to you. Maybe it's an overtly sexual act. Maybe it's just a little bit of a it's like a just like a little foreplay or something, or like he'll figure out you like. You know, to have your ear kissed or something. You know, just, you know, something that you go, ooh, that's nice. But then because he's a jackass guy who just doesn't know any better, he just then does that one thing over and over again. Mm-hmm. It's just like finding the one button and go, I'll just press this, you know, for like an hour. And until finally the thing doesn't even really have any effect on you anymore because he's burned it out. That is the thing about the guy. If he finds anything that has a remotely positive response, he will just burn out that section of the punch card unless he is directed to do something different or to broaden his approach at all.
But also, in defense of guys, women, we've been raised to believe, even now, even young women today, there is this belief, I think, to a certain extent, that if you tell a man what it is you want, you're being pushy. He's not going to like it if you are aggressive and you're pushy.
Whore.
And then you're too slutty and too whorish if you actually like sex and know what you want. And the thing that I think most women don't understand is that men really, really like it when you tell them what it is works for.
Oh, yeah, because otherwise
I mean, as long as you're not going, no, not like that, stupid. But if you go, hey, you know what I like is if you do this. And men go, woohoo, she's hot. Well, she's telling me stuff.
Because otherwise it's like you're just playing Myst and you're just walking around. And, you you don't even have the little cheat book. You don't even have the hint guide that came with it.
Well, it's not just helpful, but men also find that sexy.
Yes.
Because it means that you actually like sex and you know your body, but it means you like sex. You're not just laying there hoping he'll get it right. You're actually, you know something?
Try this. Also, guys like to know that they're doing a good job because somebody, here's one of the truest things ever. Somebody once said to me that 90% of a woman's libido is how she feels about herself. Because we were having some argument about, you know, women, whether women put on makeup for other women or for themselves or for men or whatever. And she said, well, you know, 90% of a woman's sexual drive is how sexy she feels that she is. And I said, oh, okay, that makes sense. But the thing about it is that if, guys, though, have that whole thing of like wanting to feel like they're performing like a man. And so much of guys, you know, their performance and their confidence and their whatever, that's all tied into whether or not they feel like they're getting the job done.
Yeah.
And it's a lot easier to get the job done when somebody says, here's the job. And here's how you do it. And you go, great, awesome, I'm there. Because otherwise, you are basically just left in a kitchen that has 500 shelves and 300 drawers full of ingredients, and you're told to make a muffin. And you're just going, okay, I don't have any, what again? You go, you know, just make, you know, here's what you need. I need you to make this, where they show you the picture of the pastry, but they don't give you the actual recipe. They show you a picture of the final product, and they show you a room full of ingredients. And it's up to you to figure out, like, the combination that you use everything in.
And then the woman says, no, that's fine. That's a good muffin. That's great. And then she tells her friends the next day, he has no idea how to make a muffin.
No, honestly.
I can't believe he doesn't know how to make a muffin.
No, honestly, honey, it felt good just to feel you. No, really. No, that's no, just, no, it was just, just nice for you to, I'm going to duck into the shower for a second if it's okay with you. If you don't mind. All right? Okay? Thanks. Great. Which is my final thought about this, and then we'll do one more. We'll talk to Aaron Duran with The Week in Geek here in a second, so forth. Lots to get through today. Walking Dead, Corpse Watch, Penis Watch, Boardwalk Empire, all that. The final thing about it is this, too. When I was in Utah, so it would have been like in the early to mid 90s. And I said for the longest time, I don't know whether this would be the same now. If I were dating now, this might change. So I don't know if this was a function of my age or if it was a function of older women just being the more attractive in general. But, you know, I think I went through a long period of time where I never dated anybody that was not at least a few years older than I was. You know, when I was like, I don't know, 19, 20, 22, 23, 24, whatever, however long I was there, everybody I dated was, you know, all the women I dated were in their 30s. Because it was just like, you know, because it was like chicks who were my own age at that time. It wasn't even that they didn't know what they were doing. It's like they probably didn't. They probably didn't, because I think it takes women a long time to figure out what they want, even in their own heads. And then, but it's like once, I will say this about guys being one-celled organisms. Once guys figure out what they want, then like the equation is done. Like the problem solved and they're good to go. Women, though, it's like a whole multi-step process. They have to figure out what they want. Then they have to figure out if it's okay that they want it. And will they, you know, what will other people think about them wanting that? What will the man think about them wanting that? Then they have to realize they don't care. Then they have to actually get to the point where they're okay just telling the guy what they want. And so by the time a woman is like 35, especially, here's a tip for you single men out there, especially if she is recently divorced, if you meet a woman who's 35 years of age and who's recently divorced, she has reached the point in her life where she said, like, F that. It's time for me to get mine. And so the upshot of that is she's going to have no issue telling you exactly like how to get from point A to point Z. And the entire thing is going to be better because of it. When I was 20, I think I must have been 20. When I was 20, I dated this woman who was 43. And let me tell you, that's a woman who knew a thing or two about a thing or two. And I came out the other side of that relationship a wiser and smarter man. So you could do worse, you young guys, than to date a woman who is of that age. I'm just saying. Little advice from media. It's a little free tip from Rick Emerson. Let's do one more, and then we'll ring up Aaron Duran for the week in Geek.
Oh, okay. In a novel bid to combat illegal cannabis cultivation, Dutch authorities started handing out 30,000 cards with a marijuana odor to alert citizens what their neighbors may be up to. Citizens must be alerted to the dangers they face as a result of these plantations, and if they become aware of any suspect situations, they must report them, said Arnie Luce, spokesman for the government-appointed Working Group on Cannabis Cultivation. Though it remains technically illegal, the Netherlands decriminalized the consumption and possession of other 5 grams of cannabis in 1976 under a tolerance policy. Citizens may grow no more than 5 plants for personal use. Bulk cannabis cultivation and retail remain illegal and are in the hands of criminal organizations and a black market business worth some $2.76 billion per year. Assist in combating cannabis plantations, reads the green scratch card of about 20 centimeters by 10, being distributed to residents of the western cities of The Hague and Rotterdam. With 2 boxes that release a cannabis odor when scratched, the card also lists a police telephone number. Organizer said this was a first for the Netherlands and a pilot project for possible expansion.
Well, there's a whole line of cannabis candies they have here in the States where it's like a lollipop and a whatever, and they all taste of pot, or they smell of pot or whatever. Mm-hmm. So have you ever, let me just ask you this, just as a side note, have you ever seen that How It's Made where they talk about the scratch and sniff stickers?
No,
that is a fantastically fascinating process. Not unlike the episode where they talk about the creation of M&Ms, which is just like jaw droppingly complex. Notes here. So Aaron Duran just rang in a moment ago to let us know that he has had an issue come up. He may be joining us later on in the program. If not, we will have that tomorrow. So an issue has come up with Aaron. So we'll talk to him either later today or tomorrow for the Week in Geek. Couple of brief messages, then we'll take a break. This one says, Rick, about bras. Everyone knows that women's breasts had pointy nipples back in the 50s. It wasn't until a few decades ago that nipples evolved into round nubs.
That is
strange,
true.
But true.
That is true.
Let's see. Dawn is having a bad day with cities and their names, says this message. And finally, men make up for the confusion of the vagina by not caring. Followed by a smiley face that is tipping a top hat at me. Thank you.
Hat makes that remark classy.
This is, by the way, somebody asks about the Cosmopolitan article about giving a man a bit of hand release if step number 3 is profit. I would say only if you're really good at it, sir. If you're doing it well, then yes, absolutely. You were listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. Still to come, we have your Walking Dead recap, your Boardwalk Empire recap. We got the Corpse Watch. We got your Penis Watch and the top 5 songs about zombies. Stay right there.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Yes, Don?
Step number 3 actually is work the grand finale.
Ah. Okay. Did they really call it the grand finale?
That's what it says.
Is that like when you're watching the fireworks display over the Willamette every year and you're trying to figure out exactly when it's done?
Oh, it does start with, now, focus on the head of his penis.
Please stop.
Yeah, it has more nerve endings than any other area does.
Don't, please.
It craves extra stimulation.
No. See, now you're just goading me here. Let me just say this, and I speak now on behalf of men who maybe have, because it's not just women who are sometimes reluctant to say you know, like what's what and what is, you know, when the lights are green and when the lights are red or whatever. The thing I think that women need to know is that, you know, there's that whole thing of, you know, like a car going 0 to 60, you know, in 5 seconds. The opposite really happens for men once everything is finished, like a 60 to zero in sort of a, that's like a yes, 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 stop. Stop,
yes.
Stop, please, stop, for the love of, no, stop, over, done, finished. Women don't realize the whole extra sensitivity thing, that turns on you pretty quickly there.
Yeah.
Especially because...
And also that's just badly put.
Yeah.
Because if something has more nerve endings, it doesn't require extra stimulation.
That's the thing. It doesn't mean that you immediately just like a vice grip.
It actually would need less stimulation because it has a... Anyway.
Yeah, it's not a Stretch Armstrong, ladies. So let's ease up a little bit. Here's the thing about the grip there. You don't really want a kung fu grip on that. You want maybe a, you know, like maybe somebody's grandmother with a palsy kind of a grip.
Yeah.
That's a less is more right there in that particular part of the... Let's move on from this subject.
Okay.
You know what else is complicated, Dawn, is electricity. Maybe maybe more or less complicated than this particular act of intimacy. I really couldn't say, not having more than a passing knowledge of electricity. But you know, but fortunately, that's why folks like Squires Electric exist. So you don't have to find out the wrong way. And the wrong way is going in and just sticking a screwdriver into the fuse box in the basement because something started flickering upstairs, and you decided that the idea was just to. As men do, just start throwing switches randomly, thinking that some combination of things will have the desired effect. Usually that doesn't work, and you just end up having a long evening of sitting in the emergency room. Squires Electric. They are fully licensed, bonded, and insured electrical contractors. They can come to your home, come to your business, come to your office. Make sure, first of all, that the wiring is done correctly. So if you're moving into a new building, if you've just, if you've expanded your house, you've added another room on, or if you've moved into an office that maybe had a different type of business being done there before, and you don't think the Ethernet wiring is up to snuff, it's just not going to be able to handle the demands of your company, you can have Squires Electric do all of that. And as they often say, when Squires Electric leaves your home or leaves your business, whatever you had them do, whatever you had them fix, adjust, alter, augment or repair, it just works. That really is the bottom line. It just works, and it works properly. Now, in the rare event that they're not able to fix the problem entirely that night, they're going to get it fixed to the point where it actually functions properly, where it actually is working, and then they'll get a permanent fix put in the next day.
So they don't just give up and go home.
No, they don't. They stick around until something is done, Dawn. They're there for the long haul, is what they are.
That's excellent.
No job too small, no job too big. 503-252-1609 is how you contact them. 503-252-1609 or SquiresElectric.com. It has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business. They can make your life easier. Squires Electric.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
got a good price when I sold my soul. Cause baby, I do love rock and roll. Baby, I do love rock and roll. Yeah, I do, baby, I do love. I do, baby, I do love. Build high your wall now, do your best. Let's leave them sifting through the ashes for a glow. Baby, I do love rock and roll. Baby, I do love rock and roll. Come on, sugar, but don't it get you high? Let the rain fall down and your rivers overflow. I'll jump right in, the water's fine and it ain't too deep, you know. I do love rock and roll. Baby, I do love rock and roll. Was that another decade coming, gone? Whoa! Hey, 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 hey! You kids, get off of my lawn! Oh, the youth these days is out of control. Baby, I do love rock and roll. Baby, I do love rock and roll. I do love rock and roll. I do, baby, I do. I do love. I do, baby, I do. I do love. I do, baby, I do. I do love. Come on.
Preacher, when the story began of the choice of a lady and the love of a man, how he loved her so dearly, he went out of his mind. When she left him for someone that she left behind, and he cried like a baby, he screamed like a panther in the middle of the night, and he saddled his pony.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Still to come, unbelievably, we haven't even gotten to the actual penis watch yet.
No.
Corpse watch, and we'll also get the top five songs about zombies. That is top five zombie. I should rephrase that, actually, because as I noted last week, I think it's actually not the top five songs about zombies as such. It is the top five songs containing the word zombie in their title. By the way, just for purposes of clarification ahead of time, I have excluded any and all psychobilly recordings, because otherwise it would just be a bunch of guys who all look like that guy from the Stray Cats, you know, singing about something, and it, you know, we're in one of those recordings where it sounds like they're recording inside a coffee can down the hall. So we're not going to be doing that. It's 503-505-6964. We'll also recap last night's Walking Dead and Boardwalk Empire. We'll have a few thoughts about Eastbound and Down, which concluded its second season run last night. At the news desk, ladies and gentlefolk, it's Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Well, we do have a story from your hometown. brought to us from alert listener Dan.
So Dan said this to me, and I have only read the headline. He sent it to me, and he said, hey, here's a story from Kennewick. It's actually from the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, which is right on the outskirts of that fair city. And I saw his subject line, and I saw the headline of the email or of the story, and I printed it out, and I haven't read the rest of it. So right. I only have the vaguest knowledge of the story. I didn't want to spoil myself for it. So.
Well, a radioactive rabbit was trapped on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, and Washington State Health Department workers have been searching for contaminated rabbit droppings.
Awesome.
The regional director of the Office of Radiation Protection, our Earl Fordham, said Thursday that no contaminated droppings have been found in areas accessible to the public.
The public is in no danger at any time, Don.
The Tri-City Herald reports that officials suspect the rabbit sipped some water left from the recent demolition of a Cold War-era building used in the production of nuclear weapons. The rabbit was trapped in the past week and was highly contaminated with radioactive cesium. It was killed and disposed of as radioactive waste.
Doesn't it seem like there ought to be a disproportionate number of superheroes or supervillains coming from my hometown right about now?
There should.
I mean, it's like everybody's
origin story. Aren't?
Well, that's a fair point. I guess I don't.
Maybe you yourself are actually a superhero, and this is your mild-mannered
This is my everyday
identity.
Persona.
Yes.
The only superpower I really have is one of just almost unbelievable annoyance. That's really it. It's I'm sort of a mystery man in that some guys shovel, some guys just some guys drone. That's me. I'm the droner. I'm the lecturer. The only thing I won't say the only thing interesting about the story. I mean, I guess a radioactive rabbit who got that way because he was sipping radioactive water that was, just left sitting around in the town. I suppose that's interesting if this sort of thing didn't happen with astonishing regularity in Kennewick. The only thing that is really interesting about this particular story is that it was discovered by the Tri-City Herald, which is a newspaper basically staffed by 5-year-olds. Yeah. I mean, it's just the biggest bunch of boobs you could possibly imagine who work there. And the fact that they were able to crack this story, which is not like a thing as commonplace as it is, it's not like a thing the government goes out of their way to let everybody know. I mean, the government – I had a friend of mine when I was growing up, and his dad was actually the guy who would get on television behind the podium every time something like this would happen, and he would actually say that phrase. There was at no time any danger posed to the public by the radioactive gnats that escaped by the billions from reactor number 5 and then flew over the city in a black cloud, darkening the sun and attacking school children everywhere, when everybody there – knew that, like the radioactive gnats had actually sat down on the other side of town and had savaged a group of old people and, whatever. So, I mean, it's a thankless job to work at that facility just like it is to work at the White House, where you just have to get on camera and just lie through your teeth to a group of people who know you are lying. Anyway, so there you go. So there's that blah, blah, blah radioactive rabbit, which is, yeah. I will say this, however unfortunate it is that I'm going to die of thyroid cancer at some, at some point in the not-too-distant future, you have to acknowledge that there's a certain amount of grim humor that comes from the fact that we've got a town. Because normally you have to go to Russia to find stories like this, right?
Yeah.
You have to go to, the outskirts of Georgia, in Asia or something, just to find a place where you've got radioactive – what are rabbits? They're not felines. They're
lupines.
Lupines?
Mm-hmm.
Would have been a lot funnier if I'd known that.
No, lupines are wolves.
Is that true?
No, because I was confusing it with lapine, which is French for rabbit.
They're – the hell are they? Well, now I feel better that you don't actually know it either.
I don't know.
All right, well, whatever. But, I mean, the fact that right here, you don't have to go overseas for this sort of thing anymore. You've got rabbits that are radioactive hopping around. That's a little local color. That's not a thing that you get all that often,
in
most parts
of the world. I like to think that before they captured that rabbit and killed it, he managed to take out a few of them with his laser eyes.
I've told you this before. There's that whole thing where they did that study a while back, and it was like 20% of all the plant and animal life they found on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation was radioactive. So like 20% of all the insects and all the plants, which is sort of great because it means that 20% of everything is radioactive. And so there are hordes of radioactive insects just freely roaming the environment there.
I get to go on a tour of Trojan when they were getting ready to close it down, because I was working at a newspaper down there at the time in Columbia County. And it really was fascinating. It really was interesting. But there's also the thing of what are these big, giant cement tubes that are sitting out back. It's like, ah, that's just some stuff from inside that we didn't know what to do with.
It's so some waste.
We're just going to, like, leave it lay out here until we figure out where to put it. Don't go over there.
Here's a trick.
Like, really? That's don't go over there?
Don't look at it for too long. Here's a fun fact, actually. So they had this whole thing going on in the 40s and the 50s called the Manhattan Project. And so they were making all of this plutonium and all this, you know, this generating all this nuclear waste. And they decided, somewhat ill-advisedly, that the best way to deal with it was just to stick it in barrels, you know, like the regular kind that you see bums warming their hands over in Detroit, and just to stick it in the ground. And of course, there isn't actual, like, earth or dirt in Canada. There's just sand. And so they immediately would leach out of the barrels and into the ground. And they thought, well, that wasn't very clever of us. Let's find a better way to dispose of all these barrels of nuclear waste. So I kid you not, this is sort of at least not in my backyard kind of a thing, because they then took thousands and thousands of barrels full of nuclear waste from Kennewick. They put them on a ship and they went out off. Where is it? Is Catalina a single island, or is it a series of islands?
It's a single island.
Okay, single. So they went near Catalina Island off the coast of California, and they just started throwing barrels of nuclear waste overboard into the ocean. But then here's the thing. They didn't sink because, you know, they're sealed barrels. They just kept floating. So they had all of these barrels of nuclear waste floating in the Pacific Ocean right near Catalina Island off California. And so what's the best and fastest way to make those barrels sink? Yes, you machine gun them from the boat. I swear to God, I'm not making it up. That is a checkable fact.
Yeah.
Where the government would just throw barrels of nuclear waste over and then fill them full of holes from machine guns so that they would sink, so that seawater could pour in, and then presumably plutonium would have the option of either staying in the barrel or, you know, flowing out into the ocean. So it's just awesome.
Well, there's I think it was about 8 years ago, there's the whole project that going on in Nevada, where they're trying to get rid of a lot of, you know, trying to figure out what to do with all this nuclear waste in Nevada. So they just found this, like, rather remote desert area, and it's like, we're just going to bury it. But we're going to put these, like, really cool markers.
We'll put some signs up.
These bronze obelisks that are these markers, to let people know they're there, because we know, like, in a few hundred years, it's still going to be radioactive.
Yeah.
So we got to, like, leave these markers that are bronze, so they'll last, so that people will know not to, like, dig or build anything here.
Oh, no, it's like you see, like, the Chernobyl, the site. It's not actually the city of Chernobyl. It's a small city in the outskirts of that, where there's that amazing photo gallery from that woman who did, like, the high-speed, like, motorcycle trip through Chernobyl, like, snapping photos all the way. And and they've just said, like, well, when are we going to be able to go back and clean that up? And the guy goes, oh, not very long, 700 or 800 years probably. You should be able to stay there for at least 10 minutes or so without growing a third eye. So it's just it's things like this why I just sort of I just sort of wash my hands of the entire, like, the environmental thing, because it doesn't really what does it matter if we have, like, slightly more or fewer trees when we're dosing everything with radiation? It just seems to be stepping over dollars to get to pennies right there. So I just can't have too much sympathy for us as a species at this point. Here's Don Taylor.
Well, gas prices have remained steady over the past 2 weeks.
According to who, Don?
Industry analyst Trilby Lundberg.
Awesome.
She tells us where gas is the cheapest and most expensive.
Let's see. This is Trilby 1.
I'll bet she makes it exciting.
San Francisco is the high, 316 for regular, and Memphis is the low, 258.
We have to get her on the phone at some point. We should interview Trilby Lundberg, because I want to know what her deal is. Like,
what else does she do during her day?
That's the thing. Or is she like one of those? Is she some sort of a petrochemical day trader, where, like, she does this for about 12 minutes a morning, where she records the prices of gas and then tells you why and what it's probably going to cost next week. And, like, that, then she just spends the rest of her day online, like, buying Beanie Babies or something. And, like, she's good to go.
Lundberg says the price of crude oil may cause a 10-cent hike in coming weeks, but holiday travel likely won't affect gas prices.
Ha! We have so much extra gasoline and so deep unemployment, low economic activity, that we're not going to see any hike in price from demand.
Were you high-ing at Trilby Lundberg right there?
Yes, I was. Holiday travel likely won't affect gas prices. It always affects gas prices. They always raise the gas prices right before a major holiday where people are going to be traveling.
Just because of
And they always say that it's, like, purely coincidental that it's right before Christmas.
Okay, I swear to God, just because of that, I'm going to find Trilby Lundberg and we're going to get her on the show. We're going to get her on sometime this week if possible. All right, there you go. Awesome. Here is Don Taylor.
Emboldened by last week's Republican sweep of Texas, state lawmakers may seek to dig themselves out of a $25 billion budget hole by just dropping out of Medicaid. Far-right conservatives are offering that possibility in impassioned news conferences, according to the Texas Tribune's Emily Ramshaw. Moderate Republicans are studying it behind closed doors, and the party's advisors on health care policy say it's being discussed more seriously than ever. But even they admit the move may be as much a huge in-your-face to Washington as anything else. Gawker notes that Perry's been doing, the governor, has been doing everything he can to agitate environmentalists, including filing 9 lawsuits against the EPA. And Steve Bannon points out that Perry wants the state to be able to opt out of Social Security, even though, as a policy matter, Perry appears to have no idea what he's talking about.
Awesome.
Bannon concludes his piece by saying, by all means, mess with Texas.
See, I mean, and here's my thing is like, don't you almost in a weird way, you just have to admire a guy who, what do they say, is going out of his way to agitate or infuriate or provoke environmentalists?
Yeah.
You know, and especially if it's like the guy who, I forget who it was, the guy last week, or like his avowed goal is to get rid of health care or something. I mean, it's just.
Yeah, this guy's like, you know, yeah, I'm going to sue the EPA and let's get rid of Medicare.
Yeah, well, it's like, I mean, it's like you can't say you don't know where he's coming from, right? Like you can't just go like, well, who knows? That guy could be up to anything. I mean, it's he's not hiding it. He's not making any secret
it's
of it.
Very much coming out of the gate and saying, well, you voted in a Republican. You're getting a Republican.
Exactly. Hey, what do you want? I'm evil. Come on now. All right.
A new study by the National Review's Matthew Schaefer indicates that NPR and Fox may have more in common than either organization would like to admit, namely hyper-partisan group of leaders.
No.
Schaefer dug through the campaign contribution records of 48 of NPR's board members and discovered that 43 of them donated exclusively to Democratic politicians or liberal nonprofits. 3 made donations to both parties, and just 2 reserved their money for Republicans. Schaefer doesn't criticize the individual board members, but says that the scandal is the uniformity of the institution. A spokesman says NPR doesn't have a litmus test for our board members. But for Schaefer, that's beside the point. He says, presumably, NPR doesn't have an official policy that board members must be liberal. But de facto, they have sure done a good job of making sure their board members are indistinguishable from that of an openly partisan organization. So, there you go. The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals halted the trial of the man accused of kidnapping Elizabeth Smart in 2002. True TV's in-session legal correspondent, Jean Cazares, says it happened right in the middle of the defense team's opening statement.
Judge said to the jurors, I have to dismiss you. There's a legal issue that has come up. You may not come back until next week. And then the judge announced to the court that the 10th Circuit Court of Appeal had issued a stay, halting this trial. Because of a writ of mandamus the defense filed late yesterday afternoon, they have wanted to change venue in this case out of the state of Utah from day one.
She's really strident about everything. She's really, whatever it is that she's talking about right there, she feels it passionately.
I have no idea what she just said, but she made me feel really agitated and nervous.
So the only thing that I found really interesting about the Elizabeth Smart thing, this is the case where it's like, I think the guy like came in the bedroom window or whatever and like snatched the chick up and then she was gone. But then they found her just like wandering around like a county fair or something with the guy.
Yeah.
Like he's some sort of, and he's kind of a Manson looking dude. And they, you know, and she.
And didn't she say she was like his, you know.
His wife.
His wife, and she had a sister wife. And
that's the thing, because he was already married. And she, incidentally, she does look like every Utah woman. I mean, if you want to know like the very definition, the personification of what the average typical Mormon girl looks like in Salt Lake City, it is Elizabeth Smart. The weird thing about the Elizabeth Smart thing is that it's sort of like a Patty Hearst deal with it. Like the parents for the longest time wouldn't let her talk to the press at all. And then when she did finally make a statement, I think she went on Oprah maybe, and it was very – I watched a bit of it. It was really, really carefully like stage handled and managed and, you know, and very – there was obviously somebody who worked through her answers with her over and over again, because you could tell they were obviously afraid that she was going to get on camera and say something like overtly nuts, like she was going to refer to him and, I still consider him my husband, you know, and it was – you know, and she was going to say something that just made her look bonkers.
Cesar says attorneys for 57-year-old Brian David Mitchell have filed a petition with the U.S. 10th Circuit Court of Appeals to move the trial out of the state.
They have wanted to change venue in this case out of the state of Utah from day one, saying they do not believe they can get a fair and impartial jury. Well, the Court of Appeals is listening. They have stopped the trial.
Really aggro.
It hurts my head to listen to her talk. It's like a knife in my forehead.
It's like somebody's hitting my tympanic membrane with some sort of a large spiky mallet.
Imagine if you worked with her and you had to hear her talk to you like every single day about like the coffee in the coffee room. Or
if I was a kooky DJ, that we would then. I wonder if it'd be like what it'd be like if she was working a drive-thru, Dawn. Let me just tell you, because I think of our earlier conversation. Now everybody's text name is something like Pointy Boob. Or Johnny the Nub is what this guy's calling himself right here. Or Nubby. Somebody says,
first take off my pants.
Back on the that's part of the Hippocratic Oath, I think. First take off the pants. Somebody says, Rick, I didn't hear either you or Don address the quad boob. What is the quad boob, you ask? That is where the cup size is too small and it forces out extra bulges over the top. He says,
indeed.
And then he says, P.S. by the way. Attention, ladies. This is, by the way, this is John passing this information along, although I concur heartily and with gusto. He says, oh, by the way, wet and slippery is better than dry and scratchy.
Mm.
Okay, so just
in
case you were wondering there, that's just a little FYI from me to you. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. These observations and these tips for a happier and more productive life are brought to you by Castalia Language Center. You can find out more about them by going to PortlandSpanish.com. That is PortlandSpanish.com. Castalia Language Center is owned and operated by one Clara Grebel. She is a native Spanish speaker from Argentina, and she is now here endeavoring to speak and to teach Spanish to adults by helping you speak it conversationally, by helping you learn it in a colloquial fashion so that wherever you go in this great big shining world of ours, you can you can speak the language like somebody who didn't just come out of a Spanish language class. So you're not just sitting there just speaking in a really well-meaning but dumb-sounding American way where you just end up talking like that woman, where you just amplify everything, being under the mistaken impression that somehow makes the words more understandable to the person to whom you're
more important.
You don't want to be Stevie from Eastbound and Down. By the way, where are you at in that episode? What is happening right now? Last night's Eastbound and Down. Where'd you pause it?
I know that they're back home and he's met up with his family again, and he's been to the school. And I think at the point, I mean, he's in the car with the teacher.
The kids in the hall guy?
Yeah.
Where is Stevie at this moment?
Stevie, I believe, is still at the apartment with the...
With Maria?
With Maria.
Is it just Maria?
I haven't gotten that far, so I don't know.
Okay. It'll all become clear.
Okay.
And you'll get to hear Stevie's thoughts on the language barrier, Dawn, which will be less of a problem for you if you go to Castalia Language Center. You can find out more at PortlandSpanish.com. PortlandSpanish.com. And here's the thing. If you have not watched this season of Eastbound and Down, first of all, if you haven't watched the first season, you really need to do that. Then you need to watch the second season. And you will learn all of the many things, or perhaps many of the many things, that can befall you if you are not entirely familiar with the language in the place where you are living. It can lead to any number of misunderstandings, both comical and unfortunate. So you can find out more at PortlandSpanish.com, Castalia Language Center, where they realize that the best way for you to learn something is not just to memorize it and just to spit it back out long enough to pass the test. You can speak it like you're in a conversation, so you will learn it conversationally. That is PortlandSpanish.com. So you find Castalia Language Center. PortlandSpanish.com. Please tell me you heard it right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Well, let's continue the theme of today's show with our penis watch.
And actually, before we even roll the penis watch, I should say that somebody without a name here, just Johnny Nameless, says, ladies, my penis is not a BMX bike.
Well, I should hope not.
I mean, okay. I mean... If you feel like you really want to make that distinction. All right, so that guy, his penis, just in case you were under the impression that it was, in fact, or a huffy, it's not. Just
would it be the lack of shock absorbers?
I don't know. Seems like there's a banana seat joke to be made here somewhere, but I don't really know what it
Take
is.
Take a look at my enormous penis. And my troubles start a-melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis. And everything is going my way.
Here is Dawn Taylor with your penis watch for Monday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
A 48-year-old Florida man.
I'm sorry, a man where?
Florida. parked his car in the front row facing the courthouse in Dade County, Florida, midday Thursday, pulled down his shorts in front of a Pasco County Sheriff's Office detective, and began masturbating. All right. When arrested on a charge of indecent exposure in public, the man, Richard M. Garcia of San Antonio, proclaimed his innocence and said he was just applying hemorrhoid cream to himself. The report states, upon looking at the bottle the defendant was holding, it was not hemorrhoid cream, but KY warming jelly.
Okay.
Garcia was released later that day from the Pasco County Jail on $150 bail.
Here's the thing about the warming jelly?
Yeah.
Is that the stuff, it's like, is that the you rub it around and it heats up, or
yes,
you blow on and it heats up or something?
Yes.
I have no experience with that. And I know that you had the unfortunate experience with the close-up toothpaste.
Right. Which, I have used the kind, that old kind that you blew on it and it got hot.
So you've actually used the according to Hoyle, like the sanctioned,
yes,
actual warming jelly. I'm not saying it would be unpleasant. I'm just saying I don't really know. It sounds like that has the potential to be a thing that doesn't feel all that great.
Well, the kind of, again, this was a very long time ago, and it seemed sort of pointless to me. I didn't really understand why one would want that. This stuff, I'm sure, is some kind of newfangled process that is completely different.
See,
than
I
the
just
stuff
wonder.
That I
here's the only thing about that warming jelly, which again,
I still don't understand the point.
Different strokes for different folks. You know, whatever. I don't get. And this is maybe I'm not adventurous enough. Like, because I like to think I'm a broad, open-minded kind of guy. I like to think that Rick Emerson is drunk deep from the cup of life. But then it's like, back to that penthouse discussion a few weeks ago where it's like everything was just about peeing and midgets.
Yeah.
And it's like you go, well, maybe I'm really dull. Like maybe I'm really, really boring and it's just no one has hit me to that fact or something. Or I've just hooked up with other dull people in my life and so it hasn't been brought into stark relief. Just before I get back into the warming gel for a second, I don't get the whole thing with the ice cube. You know, the whole like using the ice during – like there was – again with the HBO Real Sex where they're talking about Janice is in the kitchen getting her dildo made of ice from the freezer. Why would, I mean, it doesn't seem like that would feel good in any way except when you stopped. And you went, oh, thank God. Oh, Christ, it was horrible. What is the appeal, would you say, of a marital aid that is made of ice?
Well, I think that is part of it. I mean,
that it feels good when you're done?
Well, and also,
I might as well just kick you in the ear for a while. Hey, I'm done. Doesn't that feel great?
It's part of that whole thing that there are certain sensations that are kind of somewhat painful, but at the same time pleasurable at the same time. So it's like you're kind of overloading your nerve endings a little bit. It's I don't know. I've done things with ice that were awesome. I have done things with ice that were just merely annoying and like, really, dude, stop doing that. Just make that go away.
Yeah, no, I mean, because no. Otherwise it seems like if that were the case, if that felt good, you would just – it's like I always say about stovetop stuffing, Don. Thanksgiving food is the thing people don't really enjoy, and the proof of that is that they don't eat it the rest of the year. I mean, by and large
– I do.
Yeah, but I mean, most people don't. Most people don't go like, hey, it's an average day in the middle of, June. Let's get some cranberry sauce out of a can. People just don't do that typically. 80% of that food is sold during Thanksgiving. Why? Because people eat it largely because it's just the holiday. It's like the ice dildo or the overloading. If it really felt good, it seems like you just sit at work and hit yourself with a hammer.
Well, different things feel good to different people. And me personally, I think it's certainly, to a certain extent, some of those things are contextual. It's who you're with, what kind of an adventurous sort of a mood you're in at the moment, and, you know, what the lead up to it has been. Because a lot of these things, you know, a lot of stuff that's kind of kinky, like, yeah, it's really hot under the right circumstances, but if somebody just like sprung it on you and you weren't like really expecting it and they weren't somebody that you even really maybe even liked that well, if you kind of like, no, get that away from me. Ah.
This is another difference, I think, between men and women, because for men, it's not really contextual. Things that men enjoy, they enjoy all the time. Things that we don't enjoy, we don't ever enjoy. There is no shifting sand,
But I don't believe that's true.
It is true.
I mean, let's say, for example,
I don't want to go to work without pants, fair enough, and I might do that at home, but that's not about enjoyment.
But say you were a man, and I'm not saying you are, because I don't know anything about your proclivities.
I'm not saying I'm a man.
I haven't finished my sentence.
Okay.
Say you were a man who
yes.
Enjoyed it when your
I knew, lovely I know exactly what you're going to say, too.
Inserts a finger into your private area. Just kind of invades you a little bit. But you like it under certain intimate circumstances with the right person. But if you were like with some lady that this was like the first time you'd ever had sex with and you didn't know her very well, and without warning, all of a sudden it's like, whoop, there she was doing that to you, you wouldn't like that very much. You'd be annoyed, in fact. You might smack her.
I think that's less about the actual act than about the being caught off guard part of it.
But, you know, but a lot of that stuff is like that, though. It's like, hey, can I do this to you? And it's like,
if
no.
If I came up and hit you in the face with a chocolate cake, it doesn't mean you don't like chocolate cake. It means you don't like being hit in the face with it. You don't like being caught off guard with it. You still like chocolate cake.
But, I mean, there are a lot of things that, for example, if Patrick suggested to me, hey, I'd like to try this, I go, you know, there are things I would consider. There are also things I would go, no, never, no. But there are things I would consider because of our relationship. Whereas if somebody else, like, suggested it, I'd be like, are you out of your freaking mind?
Wait, so this is like where you're willing to take one for the team, maybe. You know, this is a sort of, if it makes you happy, it makes me happy.
God, well, yeah, and also, like, and I might like it. I don't know. I'm willing to experiment because I feel safe in this relationship. And I trust you.
Hmm. All right. I got lots to say about this, but we probably shouldn't. It's just it's already like 2:40, and it's just going to take us down. It's going to take us down an awkward road. Let's put it that way.
More awkward than we already are.
It's already talking about the inadvertent. I'm not even opening the Skype chat because I know that Cheryl is on there yelling at us about, you know, we've got a new client listening today. What the hell is wrong with you? All right, let's see. See, now I'm just getting sexual advice, you know, or observations from men that don't make any sense. This guy just says, don't puncture the Bavarian donut. I don't even know what that means.
But it's good advice nonetheless.
Is it? Who knows? You might like having the Bavarian donut punctured. You know, I can't even foresee. I don't even know what it is.
I don't think the word
puncturing, yeah, maybe.
Puncture does not belong in this discussion at all.
No, I suppose. I guess that's true. The only reason I was asking about the ice dildo is because of the warming gel. The thing about the warming gel that makes me...
They cancel each other out, I think.
Exactly. I wonder if they would. I wonder if it's like if it was like you had half on one and if it was like a McDLT or something. Or if it's like, have you ever noticed this? If you put your hand under... If you put one hand in hot water and one hand in cold water, it feels as though both hands are in lukewarm water.
You have a lot of time on your hands, don't you?
I do. I do. And I had no friends as a child, and so it was just me and Mr. Wizard. Yeah, but so your brain can't process the two extremes until it feels like your hands are both in lukewarm water. So I wonder if it would be the same thing with this. Also, the thing that unnerves me about the warming gel for the sex is that I don't know what they use to make it warm. Doesn't it seem like that's a chemical that shouldn't exist? Or it's like a thing we used on the Viet Cong?
It certainly seems like a chemical that you probably shouldn't be putting anywhere near your genitalia.
Yeah.
Because, and yet, I mean, that is what it's for.
But, I mean, it's a chemical that presumably only warms up if it's rubbed, in most cases, or blown on or something, mm-hmm. which means that it's a chemical of almost like otherworldly alien technology and advancement. Yeah. So I have to assume that was a byproduct of either a military experiment or that, like, we found it in a meteor in Jordy Verrill's backyard. It's, and now we're having you put it on your vagina.
It's one of those things we got from Area 51, like microchips and Velcro.
Or that flubber stuff that, that they only... Can I tell you about flubber? Here's the thing about
flubber. Flubber's not real.
No. See, you say that because you don't know what I know. You don't know all the stuff that's in my head. You don't know. Let me just finish the penis watch. Hold on a second. Here's your, there's your penis
Take
watch.
Take a look at my enormous penis. And my troubles start a-melting away. Bow, bow, I take bow. A look at my enormous penis.
I wonder what Trilby Lundberg has to say about all this. Bow, all right. Here's the thing about flubber. Now, I know that there's a flubber as in the Dr. Seuss book. I'm thinking of Oobleck.
Yeah, the Disney film.
So there's flubber, which is the thing the absent-minded professor creates mm-hmm. and it floats. And then there's Oobleck, which is the thing that Bartholomew creates in the Dr. Seuss book, Bartholomew and the Oobleck. So you'll have to just so as we go into it, here's a caveat at the beginning that I may be transposing flubber and Oobleck. Two fictitious substances, two substances that do not exist. One of those things, flubber or oobleck, and I cannot remember which, that name has now been taken and used to identify a substance that they created in a lab some years back.
I think it's flubber, actually.
It's a liquid until you hit it with a hammer, and then it becomes a solid. the hell is up with that? Have you seen that stuff?
No.
It's insane. They and I thought they were like, I thought it was a thing that like somebody was just effing with me, but it's real. They had it in a bowl or like an ashtray or something, and it was like a tub of it, and it's a liquid. It's like maybe like a, it looks like a, maybe like pancake batter, you know, where it's not sludgy, but it's sort of a thick liquid, but it's very clearly a liquid. And but then a guy took a hammer and he went, watch this, and he like hit it with a hammer, and it became a solid at the point of contact. Until he lifted the hammer back up, and then it went back to being a liquid. And it just broke my brain. It just bent my brain, and it's a real thing that exists.
Wow.
It is a liquid until you hit it with something. Then it's a solid, but just for the second of impact. And then as soon as the impact is done, then it went and went back to being a went back to being a liquid. And they either called it oobleck or flubber or one of the two. And it's just, like, where the hell did that come from?
Wow. I don't...
Forget magnets. How the F does that work?
And what do you... What's the point of that? What are you going to use it for?
As a sexual aid, clearly, in the future. That's the thing. They'll make it some sort of liquid sex doll that just becomes solid at the moment of at the moment of the apogee of the thrust. Well, you tell me. What the hell are they going to use it for? That's what I'm saying. There's no use for that. There is no use for that except to terrify me. That's the. It's like they make stuff in a lab just to screw with us, to remind us of the stuff they've got, so that we wonder, well, what else do they have? We better not cause any – we better not start a revolution, because I wonder what they've got in that lab that they haven't – I mean, if they're willing to tell us that they've got a thing that is like a liquid, then a solid, then a liquid again, and it just magically knows how to do it, or if they've got like some gel that is one temperature until you like touch it, then it becomes another temperature, then it goes back to being the first temperature again, and you can buy it for like a dollar at Walgreens. What do they have in like that that Raiders of the Lost Ark warehouse that we don't know about? Science is effed, man. It is effed. It's completely effed. 100%. All the way. All right. Sorry. Go ahead.
I don't even know what to talk about now. It was here. Well, here we go. A major hazardous material cleanup has begun in Oceanside, California, where several dangerous chemicals used for pest control were found left behind in a recently foreclosed home. A woman who was moving out told firefighters her husband had worked with chemicals for many years and had owned a company buying and selling hazardous materials and making devices to kill gophers.
Awesome.
These devices included toxic smoke-producing powder, along with bombs that detonate inside gopher burrows. The woman's husband died of gastrointestinal cancer in 2008,
it's hard to believe,
leaving the material behind in four storage buildings that had been built in the couple's backyard, adding that numerous containers were also found outside the buildings, hidden in the weeds.
By the way, let me tell you this. You know, when Laura went to when she went to the Amazon, I guess it would have been last November, she said one of the best things about going to, and it never really occurred to me, she said one of the best things about traveling to another country is you get to use all the really effective drugs and chemicals that are illegal here. So it's like the minute they got to the Amazon, the guy's like, here you go, here's some DDT, which I don't think you can have now because it gives your kids like three heads or something. I mean, but you can't have it in America. There, I mean, it was like at every store for like 50 cents. You just buy yourself like a big tub of, you know, a big atomizer of DDT that you douse yourself with.
I think you're thinking of DEET.
No, I think DEET is the thing you can buy now. DEET is the...
No, DEET is illegal here. It's the stuff that you was actually in...
I believe DEET is the brand name, but DDT is the chemical. DDT is the chemical abbreviation because DDT is not unlike Agent Orange. It's another defoliant that we used in Vietnam, you know, so that we could...
But you're talking about something that people are spraying on themselves to deflect insects?
Well, to deflect or kill or...
Well, because DDT is something you spray. It's an insecticide you spray at other things. DEET was the stuff that you would put on yourself. It was in lotions to reflect.
Now, I've looked it up right here. So DDT is both. DDT was DDT is a thing that is actually sprayed on the outside, but it was also the active ingredient in many many topical anti-insecticides and pesticides.
Now, if you look up DEET.
Well, yeah, that's a thing you put on your body, but the active chemical in it was DDT, and it warps your kids or it does something horrible to them. But see, they don't care about that in the rest of the world.
No.
They just like the thing to work, and it's like they fix the other thing later. So, you know, I'm just saying.
There was also a 3-foot-wide, 3-foot-deep underground storage area on this property, found with several containers of unidentified liquids. Representatives from the county's health department and hazardous material teams from San Diego Fire and Rescue Department and Camp Pendleton's Fire Department were called to the scene, along with members of the Sheriff's Department's arson and bomb squad. 12 hazardous material technicians worked for more than 5 hours to locate and identify all the material. They sorted through some labeled containers and many unmarked bottles, drums, bags, and boxes. By nightfall, about 2,000 pounds of aluminum powder was removed from the site, adding that a cleanup company had been assigned to begin removing the remaining hazardous materials today. In the meantime, an Oceanside police officer remained at the house to provide security.
Good God almighty. All right. And you know that there's guys like that everywhere. You know, these nutcase dudes who've just been stockpiling chemicals or you know, just some Mythbusters popular science type who's been at home and he's been building an aircraft carrier and a, you know, and a nuclear reactor, like, in his basement.
Oh, you know, there's at least one guy in, like, Skephoose who has, like, a whole, like, you know, Quonset hut that's just full of gopher-killing poison powder.
Undoubtedly. By the way, somebody wants it to be known that Dawn is correct. There's an entire sex industry involved around electrocuting people's junk.
Okay. There is indeed.
Well, fair enough. All right, here's Dawn Taylor.
Let's do our corpse watch.
All right.
What? Okay. Do you want to read another message?
No, I don't. I don't, and you don't want to hear it either.
Yes, I do.
No, it's just it starts with a thing about a thing that there's a thing I clip onto my urethra.
Okay, no, I don't really
know. No, I'm sorry. What are we doing here?
Corpse watch.
All right, because we don't want to hear anything tasteless. Here's your corpse watch for Monday.
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones.
We've really just spiraled down a hole today, haven't we?
It's your fault. You brought in the Cosmo. It's Helen Gurley Brown's fault. Hey, is she still alive?
No.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, because she looked dead for a long time, even though she wasn't.
I'm pretty sure she... Yeah, no, she died.
Okay, all right. Here's your corpse watch for Monday. This is Dawn Taylor.
A New Zealand computer programmer murdered his Thai girlfriend, then lived with her decomposing body in a lounge, which I guess is their living room, in the living room for nearly a month. Gordon Hyatt, 49, is on trial in the High Court in Auckland for the murder of sex worker Nudadar Vaiku, 48, in April 2009. Crown Prosecutor Rachel Reed said Hyatt told police he had choked her after an argument got out of control. Reed said Hyatt killed Vaiku on April 16th, but continued living at her Western Springs, Auckland flat for over 3 weeks, going about life as normal, taking trips to Wellington, visiting sex workers, and going to family gatherings. The police officers who responded to a call from Vaiku's landlord on May 12th were greeted by a smell, quote, indescribable and putrid. Dead flies and maggots littered the floor. Vaiku's body was on a double bed in a curtained-off corner of the living room, covered in blankets with a dressing gown over her head. A fan was blowing over the bed to try and alleviate the stench. An examination of Hyatt's computer showed he had been on instant chat site MSM with another girlfriend in Thailand during the time his partner of 2 years lay rotting next to him.
Doesn't anybody ever notice that these guys smell like a corpse? Like when they go to work or like if he's going to pick up some other girl?
Or when he goes to a family gathering?
Yeah, and it's like, you know, and he smells less like a daisy and more like a dead thing.
Yeah. The chat logs with his other girlfriend showed him saying Vaiku had gone and was never coming back.
Well, that's a fair point.
He later said Vaiku had, quote, made him crazy and he had killed her on Friday. In other conversations, he said he had read jokes all day to cheer himself up.
Okay.
Because that, you know, that kind of thing could put you in a bad mood.
I just see him just, you know, just sitting there in a horde of flies, but like opening one Laffy Taffy after another.
Or reading that Dr. John's Bathroom Companion to try and have a few chuckles.
Ziggy with a hat. There you go. There's your corpse watch. Jesus, God. For Monday.
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones. Exhuming things that's better left alone. I'm resurrecting memories of a love that's dead and gone. Yet tonight I'm sitting alone, digging up bones.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. So having just had the corpse watch, this is probably an appropriate point to talk about last night's episode of Walking Dead, which aired on AMC, the second episode of the first season of Frank Darabont's ongoing zombie drama. This is how we've kind of been doing this the last couple of weeks. I'll let you take the lead on this because we've both seen this, and then we'll talk about Boardwalk Empire too. Also, I'll touch briefly on Eastbound and Down, which you will have seen by tomorrow.
Yes.
And by tomorrow, also, I will have seen Dexter. So tomorrow we'll talk about Eastbound and Down and Dexter. Walking Dead last night, what'd you think?
Walking Dead, it continues to be really, really good. We were talking about it a little bit before the show, and one of the things I was mentioning is I've read, like, I think the first five books of the comic, and one of the reasons I stopped reading the graphic novel was because I really was displeased with the quality of the dialogue. The dialogue's really bad, really stilted, but the characters are still pretty interesting, and the situations are really good. The plots are good. And they're doing just a brilliant job with the miniseries of writing fresh, better dialogue, but maintaining pretty much the storyline intact. And here we ended with a cliffhanger last week with our hero in a tank, surrounded by zombies, and how's he going
to
get out?
Which was a really, really great way to end that episode. And I sometimes don't like cliffhangers. I usually don't like cliffhangers because it seems cheap. Cliffhangers to me often denote, they indicate a lack of confidence on the part of the filmmaker because they indicate that he does not believe that the story itself is compelling enough for you to come back. So he's got to like dangle this carrot to get you there. That didn't feel like that though.
Yeah.
That just seemed like, it just seemed like an old-fashioned sort of a thrill ride, like a serial, or something where it's just, all right, chapter play, where it was a very much like, and how will our hero escape from this? Tune in next week. And it was plausible, too. It wasn't like they had to cheat to somehow get him out of the tank.
No, and, of course, this brought him in contact with some other people. And so they're all trapped in this department store where he met this group of people who had been scavenging in the department store and had gotten trapped by the zombies, mainly because of him, because he was running through town shooting at things,
right,
and raising a ruckus. And we also and they're sort of types. But one of the things I like about Walking Dead, I liked about the graphic novel, is they're not really one-dimensional types. The characters are actually sort of believable people who have unusual relationships. And so you're starting to see a little bit of that here. And also we get to see the camp with the other survivors, where we are now coming to realize is his wife and his kid are, and that she apparently is having a thing with his ex-partner.
Right.
And so that's going to be awkward when he finally reunites with them.
And they will inevitably meet up. You know, that's a given.
Well, yeah, because the people he is with
they splintered off from there.
They're part of that group, and they're on their way back.
And
they're now traveling back to that camp where he is going to finally bump into his wife and daughter again and realize
that they've hooked up. And
yeah.
How closely is it following the graphic novel in terms of the storyline?
Very.
I will say, as much as I liked last night, and these are relative complaints because it is such a great series, and they do handle most of it so well. There were a few things I didn't really care for last night. One is that, as much as you say the dialogue is improved in the graphic novel, and I will trust you that it has, because because I know Darabont is a real stickler for dialogue sometimes. He also, though, has a weakness. He also has a weakness for speechifying, which is present in most of his films. And it works sometimes. It works in Shawshank Redemption. It works less well in, like, The Mist, where there's that guy, Ollie, who gives the whole thing about, well, as a species, we're fundamentally insane. You put us in a room and blah, 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 and we all turn on each other, which is all true, but it does feel very much, it's like your whole thing of John Munch on Law & Order, SVU, talking about aspartame and Diet Coke or something. It feels kind of rammed in.
Yeah.
There wasn't that necessarily last night, but there was that whole weird, his name was Robert Paulson speech he gave when they're looking at the wallet that belongs to the dead zombie before they slather themselves in guts. And that felt a little, it felt a little stagey.
Yeah.
It felt like something you would see in a play, less than something you would see in a situation where people are fighting for their lives. I also
did not really love the whole going down into the basement and looking for the way out in the bottom, only to find that there was no way they could get out through the bottom, which is the point where I'm going, well, you know, you could have, like, maybe just not even have had anyone think of that.
Well, especially because they posited it as a thing that the woman knew because she was a city planner or something, which is just one of those. And I'm glad they at least established that she was, because otherwise it was just like one of those things where a character would know something there was just like no earthly reason for them to know.
But that did seem a little awkward, too. It was like, well, you know, these buildings that were built in like 1924, they have escape routes down into the sewer underneath. Well, how? And you think, why would you know that? Well, it's my job. I'm a city planner. And like, okay,
I'm part of the strange conglomeration of characters that have been put together randomly in this building to represent all walks of life.
Yeah, didn't know. On the other hand, Michael Rooker.
Okay, so there's two things I was going to say. Yeah, there's two things. One is, as there were some things I didn't really care for last night. One of them was the thing that they do in a lot of movies like this, and that Left 4 Dead, the video game, illustrated so brilliantly, which is the person who represents every different social strata. So there is the cop, and there is the civil service worker, and there's the kid, and there's the pretty blonde girl who's in over her head, and there's the badass. And Michael Rooker, though, is the badass, and it was awesome.
Yeah.
And I got to say that they did a really... And this is a thing that Darabont does very well, where they set something up and then they undercut it, and they take it away you didn't expect, because when you first are introduced to Michael Rooker, who, you know, a lot of you guys will know from Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, and he was in Chasing Amy, and he was, you know, he's just one
Slither.
Of... Slither, not Chasing Amy, but Mallrats. He's just, and he's one of those guys that I think especially sort of Gen Xers or you know, the guys about my age remember seeing for the first time in Henry, and he made an indelible impact on you. But he's great. He's a great actor, great guy. Cliffhanger with Sylvester Stallone. But you see him, and he's, you know, shooting, you know, the zombies from the building with a bolt-action rifle. It just looks like a badass. And you're going, yeah, if you're me anyway, you're going, yeah, Rooker! But then it turns out that he's just a horrible, repellent human being. And he's a racist and a cokehead and probably homicidal. Which is a thing that I sort of like because it counters expectations. Because he's Michael Rooker, you expect him to be the cool Marine badass that saves them all at the end. But instead, he turns out to be a horrible person and is presumably just left for dead at the end of the, pardon the pun, at the end of the episode because he's handcuffed at the top of the building.
But that is what we call a comic book death, though. Because
you didn't see it happen.
You didn't see it happen. So I would not be surprised if we see Michael
Rooker.
It's like
Joan Holloway's comic book abortion.
Yes.
So there's that. I will say, and I hate to be this guy, we should get... There should be a sounder on this program, like whenever I'm about to be that guy. Like, attention, entering that guy zone. Here's the thing about last night's episode that I didn't really care for was this conceit of covering themselves in zombie goo so that the zombies wouldn't notice them, which, and I apologize for sounding like a pedantic comic book nerd, but if we're going to operate under the premise that it is a real world zombie infestation, which it's like a disease or a virus or a whatever, and so that, in other words, apart from the actual spread of the disease, everything else operates like laws in the real world would operate. That just wouldn't work because they might smell zombie, but they're surrounded by zombie. It seems like if their sense of smell is so finely attuned that they can, like, smell you from across the road or whatever, they're going to be able to smell the human through, like, whatever layer of zombie gut you get, even if they're a foot away from you, which many of them are. And it also seems ill-advised, seeing as how they know that the zombie virus is transmitted via fluids. You would just never do that. Even if you got to that point eventually, and I know I just sound like a retard, but I mean, you got to. These are the things that, because I know I'm not I'm like one of 5 billion guys having this discussion today.
Yeah.
It seems like the first tactic you would try is you would actually just try sealing yourself up entirely with just like a little vision thing to look through. You would seal yourself up in some sort of rubber or plastic to just try to hold in your own smell.
Yeah.
As opposed to just covering yourself with zombie guts, which just seemed like an excuse for Darabont to make us all gag.
Right. And my issue with the whole covering yourself with zombie guts is twofold. One is if them biting you will turn you into a zombie, then no, they do this, and this is not the first time I've seen this conceit used. So it's like, but nobody ever bothers to ask, okay, everybody, make sure you don't have any open wounds or cuts of any kind. And second of all, even honest to God, even if you didn't get turned into a zombie, if you even have just like, if those things are that toxic, if you have like just a hangnail, you know, you're going to get like a nasty staph infection from having that crap.
And he's not having anybody stand back as he's swinging the axe, splattering zombie blood everywhere.
And plus, because it's one of those cinematic conventions that drives me crazy. Like when you're watching a CSI program or a TV show where everybody's supposed to be wearing face masks and they take them off to have a conversation because, you know, we, the audience, need to see their faces while they're talking to each other.
Right.
Even though it makes no sense for them to take the thing off.
And you're inhaling zombie dust.
In this case, we're going to cover our entire bodies and everything from head to toe in this stuff so they can't smell us, except for our faces.
Right.
We're not going to cover the skin on our faces.
Well, and you got to figure that, and you know, and again, if we're going to play this out logically, you got to imagine that one of the things the zombies can smell on them is their breath.
Yes.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, that's a, you know, those dogs that can smell cancer, that they do it from your breath.
And that one zombie was right up to the guy and had his nose.
Was smelling his face, which was not covered. Yeah, which is not. So I take issue with that whole thing. I should also make two little references. These are not even criticisms, though. These are just sort of these are just little observations. One, I wonder how much that thing of covering themselves in zombie goo is taken from Serenity, where they reaver out the ship. You know, to try to, like, pass among the other Reaver ships, and they've got, you know, what's-his-name strapped to the front. He's dead, and, you know.
I can't remember what it was. Maybe somebody in the text box or somewhere. I can't remember what movie it was that I saw this done previously, though. But this isn't an original concept. I've seen this done before. The, you know, we have to get through X, and we have to smell like them. So make sure, you know, we smell like them and then, like, you know, walk like them and they won't notice.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, and I know that we have to suspend our disbelief a little bit, but it's, you would like to think that they're going to handle this in a more realistic fashion. Yeah. I think it's a minor complaint.
A realistic fashion. The zombie story.
Well, you know, but you know what I'm talking about. It's Michael Crichton science fiction as opposed to whatever, insert where the guy can just like, and then I found this portal in my bag that'll solve all of our problems. My final observation is that I bet a little bit of this. We've said many times now that it seems like The Mist was almost a dry run for Walking Dead, down to even the point of casting what's her name from The Mist, and she was also in The Shield. She played Olivia in The Shield, and now she's the blonde.
Yes.
She was the woman, and you know, and the male lead in Walking Dead is obviously the Thomas Jane character from The Mist. So, which is fine, I have no issue with that. I don't know if you ever read the Stephen King story, The Mist, that the movie's based on. It is actually deduced at one point in The Mist, the story, that the way that the spiders and the other horrible creatures can sense them is by smelling them. And so their whole thing was to try to get out by covering up and, you know, to not have their scent. So it seems like he's revisiting that idea a little bit with the covering themselves up. That being said, all of that criticism aside of the whole the logic of covering yourself in zombie guts, I do like the idea that Frank Darabont was just sitting there just going, you know, what can I do that's really going to F with people? How can I just make people squirm and vomit in their chairs at home?
Well, and the thing is, everybody's saying Darabont, but an awful lot of this stuff like
was it from the book?
Yes. I mean, now, granted, he's the one who gleefully showed us the chopping up of the body and the smooshingness and the gore. You know, he's choosing to make this as graphic as he is. But so far, there are certain changes. And the changes in plot so far, they've just mostly been circumstantial. Like in the first episode when he meets the father and son, they're living, you know, in a house in his neighborhood.
Right.
You know, as I recall in the graphic novel, he was in the city and they were on, like, you know, a very high floor in an apartment building.
I do have to say, and this is solely a me thing, by the way. This is not even, again, this is not a criticism, but it is a great show. We should tell all of this notwithstanding. It's a great show. Any sort of critique I have is just very, very minor. I personally, just I'm saying for me, I always find the last man on Earth scenario much more interesting than the ragtag band of survivors.
Yeah.
So I wish there was more of just him on foot or whatever by himself in the city, and we'll undoubtedly get more of that, but I find that much more interesting than the tight-knit group of, you know, like, you know hard scrabble, you know, folks who've made it this far and they got to stick together despite our differences, and there's no such thing as race or gender now, just dead or alive. And I'd rather see him just walking through the city with a gun.
Well, the thing that will become apparent, I think, over the next few episodes, once he reunites with the family and such, is that in a lot of ways, The Walking Dead is a soap opera,
right?
With zombies, you know, it's really about the relationships with these people, and they tend to be kind of convoluted soap opera-ish thing. It's just that the settings are not the sort of thing that you're used to seeing those kinds of relationships played out, and you're not seeing a lot of, you know, monsters getting shot in the head during your soap operas. So
it's a great show, though. It really is. And I love the production design, the color palette. It's all fan. And I also like the fact that they avoid using really you know, as I'm using a creep show here for the music, that they avoid using a really cliche score for it. I like the fact they use contemporary pop. So speaking of contemporary and things that are maybe not so contemporary, we should take a moment to talk about last night's Boardwalk Empire, which was episode 8.
Yes.
The first season. I don't know why I was reluctant to watch that show initially. Maybe because I was afraid it was going to get canceled, or I just was afraid it wasn't going to live up to... Because I heard such great things about the pilot, and I thought, well, that's Martin Scorsese. You know, the rest of them can't possibly be. But it's just... It's such a great show. That show... And I got to tell you, that woman who plays Mrs. Schroeder, where do I know her from?
I don't know. I keep thinking the same thing, and I haven't bothered to look her up.
She is such a great character and such a great actress.
Yeah.
I mean, her character is... She's the most fascinating character on the show to me.
She is, because she does nothing that you expect.
Right.
And she's turning out to be so much different than you thought she would be. You know, every turn of her character just seems so much different than you expect her to be.
And you wonder... I wonder a lot about her background in Ireland, because she seemed, especially at the beginning when she was just like a punching bag for her dick husband, just so prim and proper and just so beaten down, you know, physically and personality-wise. But then every now and again, she shows that she's really flinty and hard under the surface. I mean, and she has a backbone of just steel. And you wonder, well, what is that about? Like, what background? What is her family? Where does she come from? Like a couple episodes back when she was talking to Nucky's mistress, and she made a reference that she used a crude term for the female genitals, and she said, maybe that's not quite the draw you think it is, honey.
Yeah.
And it's where did that come from?
And this episode where she just hauls off and slaps
and
her.
And punches her, yeah.
And then says, next time it won't be that pleasant.
So I wonder, what is her background? Where did that character, you know, come from? What made her that way? And I hope we get a little bit of that at some point in the future. I'm the hugest fan of that character and of her.
It's a hard show to like recap easily because it's so rich and so complex.
Yeah.
I mean, and plus the things that are going on in it don't necessarily sound really interesting on the surface. It's like right now the focus is on the Democratic National Convention.
It's all about Warren Harding.
Where Nucky is going and wheeling and dealing, and he just met Warren Harding, and that doesn't sound, you know, and there's some intrigue going on about getting Nucky the highway money, and that doesn't really sound that interesting,
right.
But it's fascinating. And you know, we had him, Nucky encountered Jimmy again for the first time in a while, and you know,
I dig Jimmy too. He is my second favorite character on the show because he is that guy. He is an archetype that I find endlessly fascinating, and that is the smart guy trapped in a dumb life or a dumb job or a dumb body, you know? Maybe the guy who's way smarter than he's been allowed to be.
I think possibly my favorite thing in the show so far was his trip to the Veterans Hospital.
Yeah.
And him meeting the guy who'd had like half of his face blown off.
Oh,
basically making the decision that neither one of them really need to undergo the psychiatric, you know, testing and them... You know, just walking out of it.
I'm stating the obvious, but how creepy is that guy? And not just because he's got, like, he's missing his face, and he's got, like, you know, this guy who's a sharpshooter, and he's missing an eye, and so they gave him this really crude prosthetic.
Fake face.
Yeah, like...
Fake half a face.
Yeah, it's like this terrible one-third prosthetic for his face, which just makes him look evil. You know, that's Angelica Houston's kid.
Is it?
John Houston's grandson.
Oh, my God.
I forget his name. It's like Stephen Houston
he's
or something.
He's really good,
he's
and that character
really good.
Is really... disturbing.
And it would be easy to say that he's really just good and disturbing because he's wearing the prosthetic, but it's not. I mean, he fills that character with some sort of not even evil. He's just one of those guys who has just been so permanently unsettled by the war that he's just a watch that doesn't tell the right time anymore.
And we actually got a little bit more background now about why Agent Nelson's relationship with his wife is as chilly and
she's
as uncomfortable
barren.
As it is. Yeah. And what was that deal with him getting the envelopes full of money addressed to her and then throwing them in a drawer?
Well, he's intercepting her mail, clearly.
Yeah.
Because she's trying to gather the money to go to a fertility clinic to get her womb, you know, fertilized or, you know,
but
fixed
someone,
or whatever.
Someone like a family member
must be sending her money.
Has been for some time because there's a whole envelope, the whole drawer.
And he's just taking it.
But not actually taking the money, just throwing it all wholesale into a drawer and not giving it to her.
Yeah,
because he's crazy.
Yeah, because he's crazy and works for the FBI, and that's what he can do. And then at the last moment, he just does that dick thing of sticking in his own letter. You know, like, sorry, you know, accept the fact that your insides are a rocky place, you know, or whatever. So,
but then you know, he like, you know,
flagellates himself with a belt.
Yeah, while thinking about Margaret Schroeder.
That guy, he's the weirdest looking guy, too. That actor's incredibly weird looking.
I really like, I read a short interview with him where he said when he was hired for this role and they were talking to him about the part and he hadn't read the script yet, he's going, I'm going to be an FBI agent.
Yeah.
This is going to be great.
Be a G-man.
I'm going to be like a wholesome, lawman, and I'm going to be bringing down the bad guys and firing guns. And he's like, oh, it's another role where I'm a creepy guy.
Yeah. So you really ought to be watching Boardwalk Empire and Walking Dead. Tomorrow we'll talk Eastbound and Down and Dexter, ladies and gentlefolk. Here in just one moment, we'll do today's top five, the top five songs with zombie in the title. You can find that list in your Dropbox, Don Taylor.
Ooh,
do that here in just one second. You're listening to the Rick Emerson radio program.
Dropbox.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Really? Yeah. What do you mean by that, Don?
You said Dropbox.
Uh-huh. Okay. Let's take a moment to thank CJ's High Climbing for being one of our fine business partners and for making conversations like this possible. Because otherwise, Don and I would just be sitting, on a street corner somewhere talking to each other about penises and zombies and, and trying to get tuppence for it. And that really only lasts so long. But thanks to CJ's High Climbing, among other fine folks and businesses, you are able to, I was going to say have the pleasure of that conversation, but pleasure might be the wrong word. You're able to hear it in any event. It's 503-228-9278 if you want to find out more about CJ's High Climbing. 503-228-9278 or go to their website. That is cjshighclimbing.com. cjshighclimbing.com. And this is for home maintenance tasks that are messy or unpleasant or dangerous or you just don't want to do them, you don't have the time to do them, or you just, you reached a point in your life where it's time to have somebody else do that for you. And they can deal with all kinds of things around your house. These are all details included. It's not like they're just going to come and clean out your gutters and throw that stuff onto the lawn. Or if they're going to come and they clean up part of the gutter and then they find there's a downspout clog, like you get billed extra for that. Or they got to come back and make a separate appointment for it. They handle all the details, including downspout clogs or minor gutter repairs. If they find where there's just cracked or it's broken in some place, they're going to charge you extra for it. They're not going to have to, come back and revisit your home at some point. They're going to handle all those adjustments at no extra charge. They don't nickel and dime you because they want to get your business, the next year and the year after that, which means they treat you the right way. They can also give you an estimate in advance for most things using Google Earth, and they can bill you after the fact. They can invoice you later on, which means you don't have to take time off from work or wherever to stick around the house to watch a guy hosing out the gutter or whatever. And you can find out more about them at cjshighclimbing.com or 503-228-9278. 503-228-9278. CJ's High Climbing, one of the proud sponsors of the Rick Emerson radio program. CJ's High Climbing.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire!
Counting is wonderful, counting is marvelous, counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness, counting is to see I love. Don't you?
And here is Don Taylor with your top five for Monday on the Rick Emerson radio program. These are the top five songs with zombie in the title. Don Taylor, are you prepared?
I am indeed.
All right.
Number five is The Hooters, All You Zombies.
Say it. Oh, you're not. Oh, so Hooter doesn't get a giggle. So Dropbox gets a giggle, but Hooters, not even a chuckle? Not a snigger? Not a guffaw?
Too obvious, really.
All right, fine. Number five. By the way, and I have to say, just for the record, I really honestly like this song. The Hooters, an underrated band. They also had Day by Day. That was another one of their big hits. Also, their top 10 hit, And We Danced.
I'm not sure if I know even who they are. When was this?
Hooters, fronted by a guy named Robert Hazard. Big in the 80s. They came out of Philadelphia. They were one of those bands. And every region has a band like this, where they were like the biggest thing in that part of the country. And then they had a couple mainstream hits, and then they went back to just being a regional band. But they, to this day, in I think it's Philadelphia, they're massive. Robert Hazard went on to co-write some hits for other people. He co-wrote a lot of the She's So Unusual album for Cyndi Lauper. They had a song called Escalator of Life, I think. That might have been a solo joint of his, though.
Joint.
Do you remember the song?
I do. You're right. Okay.
not a bad song. Has a lot of very, very 80s sounding production. Yeah. I mean, it obviously has a dated sound to it. But it's not a bad song at all. They're a band. Hear them again for the first time, you kids. If you haven't ever heard the Hooters. Terrible name for a band, first of all. But I think they were originally called the Hoot Owls. But they went to Hooters because they thought Hoot Owls sounded too silly. But they had kind of a cool thing going.
Yeah.
And they did their biggest hit was a song called "And We Dance," which I heartily endorse. It's a great little tune. No idea what the song's about. It's like he's talking about Moses and pharaohs and the. And to Noah, it makes no sense at all.
It's about how Noah put two zombies on the ark.
Two of everything.
Doomed us all.
It doesn't even rhyme. It's like he couldn't even be bothered to come up with like a Melf, Helf, Zelf. All right. These are the top five songs with a zombie in the title. Don Taylor.
Number four, Tom Petty, Zombie Zoo. I love this song.
It's a great song. It's about a real club in Los Angeles.
All down the street, standing in line, with white lipstick and one thing on their mind. Hey, little freak with the lunch pail purse. Underneath the paint, you're just a little girl.
And you know, when I first heard this song, well, this came out in like 89 on Full Moon Fever. You know, I had, you know, we had like goth kids, although we called them new wave kids. But the whole stripy stockings metal lunchbox thing hadn't quite happened in Kennewick yet. So when he was like, hey, you little freak with the lunch pail purse, I was like, well, what the hell? What is he talking about? And he talked about driving by this club in L.A. called the Zombie Zoo and seeing what we now recognize as a very goth archetype. And being like, well, what is up? Like, where do those kids come from? And what is going on at home that makes a kid that way? And so that's what the song's about.
I really like the very kind of Bruce Springsteen-like sort of Calliope-esque organ.
Totally. That's all Jeff Lynne, the Electric Light Orchestra guy who produced this. Great song. This is such a great record. Full Moon Fever is like front to back. It's a record I would say is probably perfect.
I went on a road trip with my best friend the year this came out, and we had that on cassette in the tape deck, and we played this every single day.
Over and over.
It was like we started the day by as soon as we like packed the car up, left the hotel, whatever Motel 6 we were staying in, put in the tape. And just started, and that's all. And one of like three or four tapes we played all over and over. But we started every day with this record.
It really is a fantastic album. I mean, you could do worse than to buy this. All right, these are the top five songs with "Zombie" in the title. Don Taylor,
Ozzy Osbourne, number three, "Zombie Stomp."
So this is from "No More Tears," his last record before retirement, which, by the way, came out I think 20 years ago. I should have cut this down. The intro to the song is like 9 minutes long. It just goes on forever and ever.
The suspense is...
It's killing me.
...is awesome, though. Something's going to happen.
It's his use of atonal symmetry. And also the thing's going bang.
It's like it's coming right at me. Bats.
All right, if you're an Ozzy fan, you know the song. All right, number two.
Number two, Wednesday 13, I Walked with a Zombie. Another song. I love this song.
I
Walked with a Zombie.
I love Wednesday 13. I freaking love him. brief story about Wednesday 13 and how I came to be such a fan of this band. I went to see Alice Cooper 2 years ago, 3 years ago at the Roseland. And I'm a huge Alice Cooper fan. And it was like, who's opening? I don't know. Friday 9 something, some band. And I'm like, ah, whatever. And it's like, how often do you go in and it's an opening band you've never heard of and they're good? Like, almost never.
Yeah.
And so I got there, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes into the set, and this was the first full song I heard. They were finishing some other song, and they played this song, and I thought, what a great song this is. And then they played another song, and I was like, this song is awesome too. And then they played a third song, and they were all awesome. And I was immediately converted to being a fan of Wednesday 13. And props to Alice Cooper, too, for taking him out, because, I mean, he's like, you know, he's a classic rock act. And then he took out a band of basically 20-somethings. This is from the album Transylvania 90210, which you really ought to own. I also strongly recommend his follow-up album Fang Bang, which is great. He does some of the best wordplay this side of the Cramps, too. He does that whole, like, you know, a corpse is a corpse, of course. And I'm necrophilin' great. I don't know if we have time to get to it here, but he also... I was sold on this song the minute they got to the bridge, and there's just whoa-whoas and, like, hand claps. You should also check out his side project. It's a band called Gunfire 76 that he's a part of. And he was also in the Murder Dolls, who are great as well. If you like these guys, you'd love the Murder Dolls. These are the top five songs with Zombie in the title. Don Taylor.
Number one, The Cramps, Zombie Dance. Makes me so happy.
As much as we weren't going to do any like psychobilly or rockabilly or whatever, these guys are kind of a genre unto themselves, you know. And they obviously influenced that movement. They sort of created it too. So they are kind of their own. They're their own category. You were probably a big Cramps fan growing up.
I was. I remember I had like this, I needed a car really bad. And so my best friend's dad sold me his Volare station wagon.
His Volare.
Not just a Volare, a Volare
awesome.
Station wagon.
That's
with
fantastic.
The wood paneling down the sides.
Wow.
So, and of course I was like young and wanted everyone in the world to know how cool I was. So the first thing I did was slap a Cramps bumper sticker on the back of the Volare station wagon.
Yeah, that'll do the trick.
So they knew that I wasn't, you know.
You weren't a kid.
No, that I was hip, because I liked Cramps, even though I was driving a Volare station wagon.
My parents had a Volare. Not the station wagon, though, to be fair. God damn. Boy, the Cramps, you want to talk about... I mean, just... If I just owned, like, the trademark on their logo, just on the sticker, you know, that's one of those... Like, every time you see a guy with a Subhumans patch on his jacket, you just wonder... You hope the band just make a little something on that, you know? Or, like, the... Oh, to have been the guy that created, like, the Black Flag 4-bars or something. I mean, because it's just... The Cramps have
that
one of the most...
That was Henry.
Was it?
Yeah.
It's just one of the most recognizable logos in the world the Cramps have, because they have that cool Tales from the Crypt kind of font going on. Excellent. All right, time to bring things to a close. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District here in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Agler, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa, and so forth. After a brief musical interlude, today's Legion of News encore is followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. We will see you again tomorrow at noon for Legion of News at Cascadia.fm or right here, y'all. So thank you all for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.
Where's my dinner?
Thank you. Bitches.